ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Bite Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And welcome back with Fight Night Picks, getting set for UFC 281. Thanks so much for joining in with the channel. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. And for Matt, listen, a crazy week that we had last weekend. All sorts of fighters missing weight. We had a fight fallout at the very last second. And coming up this weekend, an absolutely stacked lineup of fights. Two title fights up at the top. The trilogy at middleweight between Israel Adesanya, the former kickboxing great. He was 75-5 as a kickboxer, longtime middleweight champ with the UFC. But out of those five losses, two of them accrued by Alex Pereira. He will be his equal in the cage coming up this weekend. Pereira in the UFC already at 3-0 and only 6-1 in his MMA career. Pereira, the former two-division glory champ. And if you have a look, we also have Carlos Sparza taking on Zhang Weili, the former champion. And in your warm-up fight to get ready for those title fights,
oh my goodness,
a possible fight of the year between the hot sauce salesman himself, Dustin Poirier, and Michael Chandler. He'll talk you into riddles. He'll lull you into sleep with a speech, but he won't with his fighting patterns. Matt, I know you're extremely excited about these fights. How could you not be, exactly? We have some big-time ones coming up this weekend.
Isn't it fun that we finally have a competitive matchup that people can really get excited for Israel Adesanya? And that's not me discrediting any of his past opponents, but at this point, you kind of know what the Izzy game plan is. He's not going to take a lot of risk. He's so technical on the feet. He's going to outpoint his opponent, not do so much that he really has to kind of lap his opponent multiple times to beat them, but we know how technical he is on the feet, and no one's really been able to get past that first hurdle to make a fight competitive with him since he has become middleweight champion.
At 205, there was one guy that did it.
Exactly. There's a test like no other out there, though. Like, for Alex Pereira, the guy being a double champion from Glory should tell you all you need to know about him. And the fact that he does hold two wins over Adesanya might give him a bit of a mental edge, and that's not something many fighters can have over a guy like Adesanya, who is very outspoken in the media. He not only beats you in the cage, he kind of beats you before you ever get into the cage because of all the talking he does. I just think this is one of those great main events that has the storylines leading up to it, the storylines that are going to be really interesting post-fight too. And with the co-main event, I'm really excited to see Weili fight Carlos Sparza. I know a lot of people just kind of assume that Weili's going to go in there and it's sort of business that's unfinished and everyone kind of seems to think they know what's going to happen. But for Weili, she's never really fought a pressure wrestler like Carlos Sparza. So I'll be very interested to see what kind of a game plan she has out there, because we know how well-rounded she's going to be. We know how good of a striker she is. I think that's a very fun co-main event.
Well, listen, we have 14 total fights on this card at the start of the week. If there's any changes, you keep locked in, as we always say with Fight Night Picks, because we will have you covered. But we're going to throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen. Let us know down below in that comment section who you have in this possible Fight of the Night. 14 up on the clock right now. You're not wrong until Saturday night. We're throwing it on over to the Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
And how could you not pick this fight? I mean, Dustin Poirier taking on Michael Chandler. And if you're focusing in on one half of the equation, your fifth-ranked lightweight Michael Chandler, listen, he went 10 years between consensus fight of the years when he fought Eddie Alvarez in 2011 and when he fought, oh my goodness, Justin Gaethje in 2021. Michael Chandler, one of those killer be killed type of styles. And for Dustin Poirier, has a fight of the year in 2018 against, you guessed it, Justin Gaethje. Like, Gaethje brings the fire. He brings the pop, the popcorn. He brings the marshmallows. He brings the party favors. Justin Gaethje's always there. He's down to get, you know, into a good time. But if you focus in on this matchup between Poirier, between Chandler, the thing that you love to see is these two guys at the upper echelon of this lightweight division. I mean, take away, strip away any opportunities at a possible title shot with a win here. The fact that these guys have this fan-friendly style leads to just absolute barn burners. I think this is going to be an amazing fight.
100%. These are two fighters where their records don't really matter at a certain point. You're only watching them for who they are and how exciting they are. And for Poirier and Chandler, they have so many different fights individually that are memorable for all the right reasons. I remember the storyline leading up to Dan Hooker versus Dustin Poirier was kind of similar to this storyline. storyline. It was Poirier coming off a failed title shot. How much does he really have left in the tank? Now, Dan Hooker at that time was in a different point in his career. I think that's fair to say. He was a surging lightweight contender. And Poirier, to his credit, was able to have another one of those fight of the night, fight of the year contenders against the younger, more, not maybe not more talented, but maybe more technical guy in Dan Hooker. Now he's going up against Michael Chandler, who is another one of these lightweight legends. I know the UFC has their own Hall of Fame. It's kind of too bad there's not just an MMA Hall of Fame, because Michael Chandler
Probably is in some guy's basement.
That's true. Hopefully that guy out there respects Michael Chandler, because Michael Chandler is definitely an MMA Hall of Famer for what he's done throughout the sport. And again, his UFC tenure has been nothing if not memorable. Whether win or loss, you know he's going in there to either get knocked out or win by knockout, and I think we all love him for it. So this should be an incredible fight.
On so many to choose from on this card, and for Brad Riddell, he's already banked fight of the nights in his UFC tenure. I mean, his first fight against Jamie Mullerkey, gets it done there. And I mean, you focus on it for a guy like Riddell, he's down on his luck. His last two fights got finished by his, you know, rival in life, Rafael Fiziev, and he also was unsuccessful, I guess, against Jalen Turner. You look at it for Renato Moicano, his last time out, 4 days notice, flies across the world, five-round main event against Rafael Dos Anjos, and he's unsuccessful in that fight in his own regard. Poured it on in the fifth round, should say, but for Moicano, a very fan-friendly style, likes to get it done with his hands, mix in his wrestling, mix in his jiu-jitsu, and for Riddell, he's sneaky with his own takedown attempts, but I think this is going to be an absolutely wild fight while lasts.
I couldn't agree more. I think this fight has fireworks written all over it, because for Brad Riddell, the comp might not be perfect. I was going to save this for later, but I'll reveal it now. Brad Riddell to me is a little bit like Ben Simmons without sort of the problems outside of, you know, the court. Just think about Ben Simmons as a player. When he came into the league, he was pretty good, but did he ever get better after that? That really was the question. For Brad Riddell, it feels like he came into the UFC almost as a refined product. We know how good his striking is, like you said. His wrestling was kind of surprising just how far along it was for where he was in his MMA career, but he has kind of hit the skid marks, and against a guy like Renato Moicano, who is so talented, who's fought a lot of marquee names at 145, at 155, this is a difficult fight for Brad Riddell to be in, because like you said, on a two-fight losing streak against another guy who is on a losing streak, who has a lot to prove. So I think this is one of those fights where both guys kind of have their back against the wall, but I think it's going to bring out the best in both of them.
And if you look at it for Riddell, the Mullerkey fight of the night, the Drew Dober fight of the night, those are both wins as well. It should be a great card. 14 fights to choose from. Let us know down below, like I said, in the comment section, who you have in the fight of the night. So last weekend, you had Marina Rodriguez taking on Amanda Lemos. That was a fight night. If you go on Fight Matrix, that was a 2 out of 5 card. Your last pay-per-view was a 4.5 star out of 5 on Fight Matrix. This pay-per-view, 4.5 star out of 5 on Fight Matrix. There's so many big names on here. As far as ranked fighters, 10 ranked fighters and your two champions, there's a lot to love. Not a single rookie on the entire card. Not a single sophomore stage for a second time out for any of these fighters. Everybody is very well established. It starts from Olberg, Nikolai Negumerianu, all the way up to the two title fights up at the top. This is one of those cards that it's not 10 and 10 fighters. It's people that exactly. You know and love, and it should actually deliver.
So last week, we gave our own rating for what we thought the card was going to be. You were a much more harsh critic than I was. You said a 3 out of 10.
Three and a half.
What is your pick on this card? For me, this is a 9.5 or a 10 out of 10. Like, there's a really good belief that by the time this card is over, it could be card of the year type stuff.
Yeah, there's not going to be any magic for me at the end of the week. I'm not going to pull a rabbit out of the hat. As long as it stays intact, 14 out of 14. I'm thinking between an 8 and a 9 and a 10. This is a big time card. There's a lot of big time marquee names. Yeah. Former interim champ Poirier, former 3-time Bellator lightweight champ Chandler, former lightweight UFC champ Frankie Edgar, the answer in his retirement bout with Chris El Guapo Gutierrez. This is a big time card. Listen, you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Get hype, get loose. Coming up this weekend, light heavyweight banger with a combined 80% finish rate and 16 total finishes between them. We have the Black Jag, Carlos Olberg, former, current, I don't know, male model, taking on Nikolai, and at the rate of getting demonetized by YouTube, Negumerianu. Rianu, but we're going to call him Nikolai for the purpose of the video, so apologies to all of the Romanian fans that are out there. Matt, due to the sake of professionalism, Nikolai is a darn good fighter, and he's not really the product that we got excited for coming into the UFC. Nikolai was out there dusting guys on the regional scene, and listen, it was a poor level of competition, but for Nikolai, I almost did it, for Nikolai, he was going out there and fighting like if Vitaly Minnikov took 12 scoops of pre-workout and decided, let's do this for one round. Yeah. Because Nikolai was going out there ankle picking, grabbing guys, suplexing them, finishing them on the ground. But for Nikolai inside of the UFC, it's been a totally different story. And I'm going to go through during this video, break down the fights that he's had inside of the UFC's octagon, and try and give you a bit of a frame-by-frame ideal of Nikolai. But if you look at it for Carlos Ulbrich, you know him, and it's not King of the Ring, it's King in the Ring. He's the former King in the Ring champ, 2017 at 100 kgs, 2019 at 90 kgs. That's where his kickboxing, and that's where his bread really does get buttered. And for Ulbrich, you can talk about the extracurriculars, the fact that, and I quote, and I will bring it up as the video goes on, you'll see it, but listen, he's touched on it in the past. He went on and did like an all-male review across the Anzac region. He has the modeling credentials. He was on Game of Bros. He was due to be on The Bachelor down there. The point of it is, for Ulbrich, very kick heavy, very much a tailored kickboxing approach to MMA. Of course, you have city kickboxing fighters on this card. Riddell, Adesanya, Dan Hooker, they travel in pairs. Well, really, two pairs makes four. Exactly. But for Ulbrich, we've just seen a little bit of a refinement in the UFC, almost finishing Kennedy and Zekshu to, you know, getting finished in that fight. But for Ulbrich, it's an interesting stylistic mix when you pair him up with a guy like Nikolai out of Romania.
Exactly, and that's why Nikolai, it really comes down to what his mindset's going to be going into this fight. Because if he does fight like that pre-UFC version that you spoke about,
I think he wins this fight 10 times out of 10.
Exactly, this is a very difficult matchup for Carlos Ulbrich. If so, gonna go for a lot of trip takedowns, a lot of chain wrestling too. And that's the real thing that a lot of these classically trained kickboxers have trouble with. They're good at defending that initial takedown attempt. That's just digging for underhooks. That's a lot of physical strength stuff. What they do struggle with is chain wrestling. And that's what Nikolai can do, especially once he gets it into the clinch up against the cage. So that'll be very interesting to see if Nikolai does incorporate the wrestling. Now, I assume he's going to, but it really does come down to how much striking is he willing to do with a guy like Carlos Ulbrich? Because you're right, with Ulbrich, we all knew what his skill set was going to be coming into the UFC. The guy can strike like an MFer, and he's very good at it. He is lightning fast for a 205er, and that's the thing that really stands out. Yes, he has incredible power. Yes, his technique is really good. But we don't often see guys with his level of hand speed in this weight class. These are big fighters at 205, and the way that Carlos Ulbrich is able to throw his combinations is very... You hate to say bantamweight because it sounds like an over-exaggeration, but I'm not really kidding when I say it. He can put his punches together in a very effective manner, and it's nice to see. But I think the case with him is always going to be just trying to figure out, okay, how much can I throw and how much can I defend to really figure out what the volume can be to go out there and win rounds? Because for Ulbrich, it does feel like he is fighting for a finish, fighting for a finish. And against a guy like Nikolai, who I think is going to be able to win some rounds with a lot of his clinch work in this fight and just smother some of that fire that can be Carlos Ulbrich, I think Ulbrich's going to really have to make use of the separation he has in this fight. But the real question mark comes down to how much separation is Nikolai willing to give him?
Well, if you look at it for Ulbrich, he does have a really kind of wide stance. Like if you look at Israel Adesanya, same thing. It's a little bit different because Adesanya moves his feet a lot better and he stands a little bit taller, whereas Ulbrich is tall and as big as he is at 205 pounds. He does kind of keep a low base. So as far as takedown defense is concerned, I'm sure for kickboxers, it's always going to be, you know, top of mind. I was going to say in the back of his mind, but it's going to be top of mind. But for Ulbrich, the nice thing about him is keeps his hand almost at like chopper level. Like he's going to keep him right here. He keeps him out and he will do a little bit of a lean back because he is taller than a lot of his opponents. But when you do look at it for Ulbrich in the UFC, a fight of the night against Kennedy and Zechiku, first round, 83 significant strikes at light heavyweight. Next round, 63, ends up getting finished. His fight against Fabio Chiron, all three judges scored at 30-27. He gets the win there. That's his first UFC win. Chiron threw 13 total significant strikes in that fight. He was in gear half for the entirety of that one. And then if you look at it his next time out and you consider like what we're talking in terms of odds, He was a decent underdog, a plus 125 against Tafan Chukwe. Chukwe was bringing the fight towards him, and then he was able to just wobble him, knock him down, finish the fight. So a big win for Carlos Ullberg versus Nikolai, who in the UFC, on just a number of days' notice, he takes on, it was 2 weeks' notice, replacing Gokhan Saki, fought one of Matt's favorite fighters in Saparbek Safarov. Safarov, all
sorts... Built like a bag of milk, to quote Craig.
All sorts of shenanigans in the cage, loses a point in the first round due to grabbing the fence. That doesn't happen all that often. The judges scored it. 29-26, 29-26, 29-27. He was, Nikolai, a minus 170 in that fight. He was a plus 200 against Alexa Kammer. Split decision win there. Wasn't much of a, you know, who won it anyway at the end of it. It was a close fight. You look at his next fight, minus 240 against Ike Villanueva. Beats him by knockout. Plus 110 against Kennedy and Zechiku. He wins, so by the laws of MMA math, Nego Mariano wins that fight. But the crazy thing is, most people thought that Kennedy and Zechiku won that fight. And the other part about it was Kennedy loses a point due to an eye poke in the third round. If that didn't happen at all, he would have won the fight convincingly.
And that's why it feels like, to me, stylistically, Nikolai should win this fight. He has the edge in grappling. And what we've learned since UFC 1, Royce Gracie taught us this all the way back when, is normally when you have a guy who's good at grappling and a guy who's good at striking, the grappling tends to win out in MMA. Now, I could also see a world, and I think you could too. Nikolai wigs it overhand right. Carlos Ullberg leans back, moves out of the way, crushes him with an uppercut, knocks him out. And Carlos Ullberg looks like he is the next contender at 205. But it does always go back to styles make fights. And I do feel like stylistically, if Nikolai does use his full toolbox and the full set of skills at his disposal, he should be able to win this fight based off his grappling alone. But again, there's a world out there where he goes out there, relies on his jab, tries to act like he's Tommy Hearns, and next thing you know, Carlos Ullberg hits him with a monster left hook and knocks him out.
So the odds in the matchup, Ullberg open a minus 200, minus 125 right now. For Nikolai, open plus 170, plus 102. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to set the over. I'm going to say over under 67.5% Ullberg. He started as that big of a favorite. I think it's going to be along those lines.
I think it's going to be over.
You think it's going to be over? It's under. 936 total votes. 64% Nikolai. What is that? 65% by knockout for the 36% that have Ullberg, 36% by decision, 59% by knockout. If you watch Nikolai's fights in the UFC, this is where I can go down through every single one of them and break it down frame by frame. The only one that we've really seen any sustained wrestling offense was his fight against Ihor Poteria, his last time out. Why? Because Nikolai was training at Extreme Couture with Eric Nixik, a guy that's going to tailor a camp around the way that you should fight. And for Nikolai, he's able to land those knees. He's able to get the finish. He was the favorite in that fight, a minus 140. But that was a good win for Nikolai to get under his belt. And if he's going to fight with any sense of takedowns and urgency, this would be the fight that I would expect it. But if I back it up, his fight against Ike Villanueva goes for a takedown, doesn't get it. His boxing stance, Nikolai's, is square. He walks guys down square. He doesn't come in at an angle and go square.
Does Carlos go for body shots?
There's a few fighters on this card that will start off, you know, with a nice stance, and then they square up when they get in bad positions. Aaron Blanchfield. But for Nikolai, he walks guys down square and tries to land with power. Carlos Ullberg, that's the perfect opportunity to land the body kicks, to land the head kicks, to hit with that. He throws long looping shots when he throws his hooks, and those are perfect opportunities for Ullberg in this fight.
Okay, if the odds were still at minus 200, I would have liked Nikolai in this matchup just based on what his skill set could be. But you have kind of convinced me into picking Carlos Ullberg, if I'm being completely honest, because I do see him having a lot of success with his own body shots in this matchup. Now, I don't know how often he's going to be able to throw things like body kicks and knees at the middle, because that might help Nikolai go for some of those takedown attempts, catch a kick, go for a trim. It might just help him get on top in that top position, because that's what's really going to matter. If Nikolai can get the takedown, that's great, but he is going to have to prioritize top position after he gets the takedown, because if Ullberg can look really good on his feet for a minute and a half, 2 minutes, you get the idea. Nikolai is really going to have to make use of that top control, get effective ground and pound off, pass the guard, you get what I mean. So I think this is a difficult fight to predict because, again, I do think based on his whole skill set, Nicolai does have a very good chance to win this fight. But I do think he is going to go in there and at least strike with Allberg for a little bit. And I do think Allberg has refined his skill set enough to at least defend a few of the initial takedown attempts, go to the body when he has to sap some of the gas tank of Nicolai, and then maybe get a knockout later on if he's able to get some of his combinations working.
It's a tough one. I mean, under 2.5 rounds is minus 155. Maybe you like that one. I like that more than the pick on either one of these two fighters. Agree. But listen, popping popcorn for me with the shirt. I do have Carlos Allberg. I know I did lean that way a little bit. If Nicolai comes in and he's going for the takedown, Nixik's got him just dialed in with the game plan. Nicolai should be able to win this fight. He was a national wrestling champion in Romania. He was also a Kempo champion over there as well. And for Allberg, that kickboxing prowess is definitely the bread and butter. And not necessarily the bare bones, but there's a little bit. It's like me and you. There's a little bit of meat on the bare bones.
But there's not a lot.
There's not a whole heck of a lot. So both of us going with Black Jag, Carlos Allberg, to get the win. His teammate, who is building kickboxing as the Black Dragon, Israel Adesanya, is going to be taking on Alex Pereira in the trilogy at the top of this card. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
It's rocking and rolling and saying, hey, if Sean O'Malley can get up to number one in this division, then so can I. We have Tiger Schulman's co-owner, the gym at Julio Arce, taking on Pura Vida BJJ's own Montel Quick Jackson, an absolute banger at bantamweight. I'm going to start it off here, Matt, because this is a little bit of a soft handoff. When Julio Arce came into the UFC, he beat Dan Ige at UFC 220. He won me over. I was all about it. And listen, I looked at Julio Arce as one of those guys that I thought was going to make a run at featherweight. He wins a number of fights there. But then he decided, hey, well, you know, I used to be pretty good at bantamweight. I'm going to move it back on over to bantamweight. I didn't think he'd continue on at bantamweight. Now he's 2-1 in this division, but I didn't think the long-term future would be here, but we're still rocking and rolling and trying to do it at 130.
We are, and it has been impressive, but the weird thing about Julio Arce is it always comes down to who his opponent is and how you feel about how he's going to do in the fight. I know that's a cryptic way of predicting it, but still, for Julio Arce, it does feel like when he fights that next level of prospect, he does struggle with them. But if you are going to be kind of an outside the top 15 guy, he's going to look very good in that type of performance. And that's where it kind of gets brought back to Montel Jackson. It's, hey, what do you really think of him at this stage of his career? Because when you look at his two losses in the UFC, they're to two very talented fighters. To Brett Johns, who I know isn't around anymore. He's now in Bellator, I believe. Yep. But Brett Johns is an extremely talented grappler, very unorthodox style of grappler as well. And Ricky Simone, a guy who many of you have probably heard of, one of the better fighters in this division. And both those guys follow very similar game plans. They use their wrestling a lot, and they were able to really ground out a guy like Montel Jackson.
Go ahead. No, I mean, the weirdest part about it is Montel Jackson, they're going to talk about
he's
it
a good
on
grappler.
Every single card. They're going to say, hey, he was an Olympic hopeful in wrestling, and when the Olympics when wrestling was abolished, squashed in the Olympics, Jackson started to train for MMA. He has a skill set somewhat similar to Molly McCann, who's also in this card, where when Molly is the hammer and you're poor at wrestling, you become the nail. But for Montel Jackson, yeah, he really struggled with the wrestling of Ricky Simone, really struggled against Brett Johns. JP Bayes had a little bit of success in the first round of their fight, and JP almost had him completely submitted twice in the first round of their fight.
Montel Jackson looked about as nervous as Mariano Rivera did in a save, though. He was in a rear naked choke, and the expression on his face was just like,
hey,
he was
next just pitch, like, it's going to be a cutter.
Montel Jackson wasn't concerned at all in his last fight against JP's. Now, he looked great in that matchup, and unfortunately for JP's, didn't have a great run. Unfortunately for JP, he didn't have the best run in the UFC, so it is very difficult to gauge how good Montel Jackson is based on that performance, because he had multiple knockdowns, he was able to defend a lot of takedowns, looked really good on the feet too. But for Jackson, he does have good offensive grappling, I would say. He's a slick guy on the ground some of his own transitions. He can threaten with a lot of submissions as well. We know how good his boxing is. He is very heavy hands, especially from the outside. But against a guy like Julio Arce, I'm going to be very curious to see what's Jackson's game plan. Is he going to be comfortable to be on the feet at range? Because I do think Arce has a wider array of strikes at his disposal. Now, does that mean he's a better striker? Maybe not, but I do think he does have more kicks to throw. I think he throws more knees. I just like the variety of strikes he throws on the feet a little bit more, and that's why I'm so interested in this fight. But I'll just go back to the point I made before we started filming. This whole card has great fights from the start of the card all the way up to the top.
So when you do look at this one, Julio Arce trained as a boxer. He's a southpaw. Montel Jackson, also a southpaw. And for Arce's last time out, I had a little bit of fun with the graphics, and I didn't put Daniel Santos. I put Daniel Willie Cat. And against Willie Cat, Julio Arce missed weight. Came in at 136.5, got the win, a win that now ages well because of how Willie Cat withstood the first round against Castaneda and then finished him in the second round. But for Arce, it was pressure, it was volume, and if I have to, I'll defend a takedown. For Arce, 94% takedown defense in the UFC. It's a big portion of his game considering how good of a boxer he is. And I listened to an Arce interview that he did with All Star, which is, of course, GHK. And over there, it was, well, I'll have to pressure him. And he knows that Jackson's going to have that 3 inches of height, 5.5 inches of reach. And Arce talked about the fact that I already fought Julian Rosa, who's taller and longer, or as long as Montel Jackson, who's also a southpaw, because he will switch stances. And he already beat Andre Yule, who does possess those same gifts of having the length that a guy like Montel Jackson has. So for Arce, the thing that I go back to is he's much more active on the feet. And he's one of those guys that dips in and out so quickly, utilizes the footwork, utilizes the speed, and throws a lot in his combinations. And for Jackson, he will toss a 1-2. He will pop the jab out there, but it's that piston left hand that hits so friggin' hard. You consider it for Montel Jackson, UFC and Dana White's Contender Series, 10 knockdowns. But 8 of those knockdowns are in the UFC. That's tied for 5th in bantamweight history. Number 1 all time, Chito Vera with 10. So for Montel Jackson, knocking guys dead, 4 knockdowns against JP Bayes' last time out. That was tough to watch. Really had a lot of success. Round 2, round 3, round 1. JP looked pretty darn good. I'm just eager to see, will the lower volume, I'm downloading your game plan of Montel Jackson, will that be able to be enough? And I know how good his power is, how good his wrestling is, how good his grappling is, but is it enough to withstand the pressure and the volume of Julio Arce? I think that's a big question out of all of this fight.
It definitely is, but the good thing about Jackson and the way that he does like to download guys' game plan is he carries his power late into the fight. Like against JP, he wasn't knocking him down early in the fight. It was later on when both guys were tired. That's the good thing about Jackson. He can kind of give away rounds, and that's a difficult thing to do in 3-round fights because, again, if you give away the first 2 rounds, you better be pretty damn confident in your ability to finish your opponent in the third. But so far, Jackson has shown the ability to damage his opponent when he really needs to. And I'm glad you bring up the reach and the height difference because that's the thing. Skill set for skill set, I do think Julio Arce is a difficult striker for a guy like Montel Jackson to deal with. But the fact that Jackson does have 5.5 inches of reach on his side and that he uses his boxing a lot, I think does help him quite a bit in this matchup.
I think it actually favors Arce in the matchup. And he has teammates that are on this card, or at least one, and Mike Trezano, who's going to be fighting. So make sure you check out that video. The other guy that he trains with primarily, Shane Burgos, the PFL's own, but he's been training with a lot of pro boxers getting ready for this matchup. So you do have a look at it. For Arce, he's been favored in all but one UFC fight.
Really?
The fight that he had against Song Yadong, he was the underdog. He's 5-2 as a favorite. For Montel Jackson, a favorite in all of his UFC fights. 5-2 there. And if you do look at it, he's been a minus 600 or minus 600 adjacent in 3 of his fights. One against Andre Sukumtoth, a boxer that will walk you down. One against Felipe Kolarish. One against Jesse Strader. And one against JP Bayes. Jesse Strader. That was a tough fight for old Jesse. But Matt, when you do focus in on this one, it is a slightly above UFC average output for Montel Jackson. Tied for 6 all-time in UFC history for strikes absorbed per minute at 1.28. So Jackson in and out, doesn't get hit a lot, can lean back, can throw that front hand out there. And the good thing about Jackson is usually leads the dance with his foot position, and he likes to hand fight and keep that lead hand out there. He's not pawing with a jab. He's holding it out there so then he can land that piston left, as we said. So you look at the odds in the matchup. Arce open a plus 130 underdog, plus 172. Montel Jackson open minus 150, minus 211. You have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to assume that they're a little bit whack, and I'm going to say over under 80% Montel Jackson.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under? It's slightly under. 856 total votes, 72% Jackson, 76% by decision. For the 28% that have Arce, 81% by decision. So most people seeing this one going to a decision. And I think if people think it's going to go to a decision, I think Julio Arce wins. Better volume, good takedown defense, and that's against decent wrestlers. I think Arce would win a decision. Now, when I went in just blind without watching any of the tape, I had Montel Jackson to win this fight. I have a hard time, though, seeing him beating Julio Arce in a decision.
I still do have Montel Jackson in the fight for this reason. I think he can drop Arce, and that's going to erase a lot of volume done by Arce leading up to those big moments by Montel Jackson. I'm not saying I'm right just because I'm making this point, but the fact that Jackson is able to carry his power very late, the fact that, like you said, it's not like he doesn't throw volume. He is above the UFC average in volume landed per minute.
3.42 significant strikes per minute. The UFC average is 3.39, so barely above the average.
But still, a guy who has that much power to be above the average is a good sign, and I do think that the fact that he does carry his power late is going to be enough. And we've only really seen Jackson struggle with very pressure heavy wrestlers in the UFC up until this point. Julio Arce doesn't necessarily have that type of a game plan. I think if anything, Jackson might be the most likely to shoot for an offensive takedown, so that's why I do find myself ever so slightly favoring Montel Jackson. But this is one of those early card fight of the night potential fights, without a doubt. Like, this could be an incredible fight.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing for Jackson, when he does throw the left hand out there, like, he's not giving you a little bit of a taste, like when you're at Costco and you're trying to sample.
Oh, he gives you the whole thing.
He's packing the whole damn thing down your throat, and you're gonna like it or you're not. And when you do focus in on the matchup for Jackson, he's been out for just over a year, picking up that big win over JP Bayes. He withdrew from a fight earlier on this year. It was actually earlier on, really early on in the year, against Tanah Bakary, withdrew from that one in the spring. And for Arce, he has been active at 135, picking up two wins to the one loss, the two wins. Andre Yule finished him, the win that he has over Daniel Santos. And of course, he did get beat by Sung Yadong, a guy who, you know, he lost to Corey Sandhagen, is what it is. I have Montel Jackson by a squeaker of a hair. I think the wrestling's the difference with the grappling. I like that Arce's trained with a lot of boxers. I love the volume, and I think he can mix in those power shots. The nice thing that I like out of Arce is, as soon as he throws a couple of rights out there to bait you, he'll go down, switch to the body, land a couple of tidy shots, and he's out before he takes any damage. But I think Jackson, the damaging left hand that Arce already knows about, the grappling prowess that he has, I have Jackson. I don't necessarily love the minus 200 line, but again, Jackson in the UFC has been at or around minus 600 four times. And he's 5-2 in the UFC. So both of us going with Montel Jackson to get the win. Some big-time fights on this card, including Poirier and Chandler. The two title fights up at the top. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Ultimate Fighter Season 27 lightweight winner Michael the Lone Wolf Trezano is coming up this weekend, getting a little bit of a hometown fight representing Ramsey, New Jersey, taking on the 63-year-old wrestling legend. Oh, wait, it's not that guy with AEW. No, it's Sungwoo Choi. The nickname is Sting. And these guys are looking to save their respective UFC careers.
Really,
and I gotta
are.
Say, I didn't think we'd be here this weekend. I also have to say, I thought I had a really good read on these two, and I don't think I have a good read on them at all at this point. Because for Sungwoo Choi, comes into the UFC, gets ground out by Mavzar Evloev, has a decent showing at the start against Gavin Tucker, then he ultimately gets finished, and then I'm left with a lot of questions. He goes on, he takes on Suman Mokhtarian, and he loses a point in that fight, but other than that, he beat that guy down.
He did.
He destroyed him. So
you can't rate Suman all that highly, though.
That's true. He picks up a win as a minus 200 underdog against Yusuf Salal by decision.
Plus
that
one.
Was a good one. Salal no longer with the company. Finishes Julian Arosa, and that was like, hey, I'm the hotness Julian Arosa. That's a good win for Choi. He goes in as a pretty big favorite against Alex Caceres, drops him, and then in a little bit of a scramble of an exchange, Caceres ends up getting the back, ends up finishing him, and his last time out, he loses split decision to Joshua Kulibao. One of the judges in that fight, referee or judge Anthony Dimitru, scored round one for Choi, where he got dropped once, twice, and he still gave him the round, which is very puzzling. So, that's Dimitru's only odd score that he's ever had judging a UFC fight, so I'll let it slide. But for Choi, he did rally in that one, had a great third round. It was a fight of the night against Kulibao. Round one, round two, Kulibao for sure. But for me, I thought Choi was destined for the rankings on the run that he was on. Even in the fight against Alex Caceres, I was impressed at the start.
I feel like there's two different kinds of a well-rounded fighter, though. You can be a well-rounded fighter who really stands out in every single area, or you could be a well-rounded fighter who you are okay in everything, but since you do struggle to be a real outlier in any singular area, it really does hold you back from reaching your full potential. And I am worried that Sungwoo Choi is slowly falling into that category, and not the one who is sort of the more refined fighter in all categories, because Is he a good offensive wrestler? Yes, he is. Is he a good striker? Yeah, he throws kicks, he throws combinations, very fast hands as well. Is he a good defensive wrestler, though? It has come back to bite him in a number of his
fights. Is he a good defensive striker?
That's very true, too. Now, I guess that's the real question. Now you're opening up something for me, and I want to talk about it. Do you think the issues he has defensively are both tied together? Do you think he does just get overwhelmed by one of the two, and then it sort of it bleeds over into the other?
He bites down on his mouthpiece, and he leads with his head in a lot of his exchanges. And but that's the biggest trouble for Troy, and Daniel Cormier talked about it in the fight against Cullibau. It was, hey, he's closing his eyes as he goes to throw his punches. And when he's going in, he closes his eyes and then he just leads with his head and wings a lot of shots. And it wins fights. I mean, he's a precise striker. He throws with a lot of power. But consider, like, forget about what Daniel Cormier had to say in that matchup. For Troy, in all of those exchanges where he's just biting down and throwing, in the majority of his fights, he's dropping guys. He's beating guys down. He's having a lot of success. Against Cullibau, who was switching stances and throwing from different angles, that's where Troy really, really struggled. Now, he showed that he had great perseverance. He got dropped. Again, they have one knockdown in the first round. They have one knockdown in the second round. He got knocked down, like, to his knee and then popped back up. And then he got dropped right after it by Cullibau in the first round. And then in the second round, he got dropped by about the same shot. But for me, for Troy, that's the trouble. It's like, hey, the guy sees red, and then he just throws defensive liabilities out there.
So I guess on the flip side, I do agree with you 100%. Is Trezano a smart enough fighter to take advantage of that? Do you think he can go out there and pitter-patter enough on the feet to really make Sung Woo Choi bite down, overextend himself? Because Trezano has shown the ability to be a good wrestle boxer. He can make you think up top, go to the ground. He's a very heavy fighter on top. So there is that type of a game plan for him to have success against a guy like Sung Woo Choi. I just question whether or not Trezano is going to have that level of fight IQ to go in there, throw those strikes, and then duck under. Because I can see Trezano have a little bit of success on the feet. And it's kind of like with Gary Trent Jr. You want to miss the first three-point shot. He's a good three-point shooter, but miss the first one. Because I don't need you to have Deion Waiters' irrational confidence. For Mike Trezano, you know what I mean? It might be bad for him to have a little bit of success early on, especially on the feet. Because that might force him to then become the more boxing-heavy version of himself. And that's the version that definitely allows Sung Woo Choi to beat him.
Well, the weird thing for Trezano, he wins the Ultimate Fighter. Did you guys watch the season? I didn't watch that one. But when you do look at it for Trezano in the UFC, he's an underdog against Joe Giannetti. Wins that fight. He's an underdog against Luis Pena. Wins that fight. He's an underdog against Grant Dawson. Loses that fight. Underdog against Ludwig Klein. Beats him impressively. He's an underdog against Hakeem Dawodu. Loses that fight. Favorite for the first time in his UFC career. Minus 225 against Lucas Almeida. It's a fight of the night. Drops Almeida. Throws, what was it, in the first round. Left hook that wobbles. Knee up the middle. Drops Almeida. Tries to finish the fight. Second round, Almeida catches him with a left hook that drops him. Bloodies him up. And then at the start of the third round, it's the same left hook that lands on Trezano that finishes him. Trezano, boxing credentials. We know this. Trains at Tiger Schulman's. Julio Arce also on this card. Shane Burgos also on this card. I'm just going to focus on the odds in the matchup really quickly. Trezano opened a minus 155, minus 134. So familiar territory for Trezano. Choi opened a minus 180, minus 163. If Choi didn't fight Cullibau his last time out, and if Trezano didn't fight Lucas Almeida's last time out, I would have said Sung Woo Choi minus 200 comfortably. But now it's not so, and though that's where the odds are. You have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. Both guys on two-fight losing streaks. I'm going to say it's relatively close, but I'll shade with the favorite here. I'm going to say over-under 65% Choi.
I think it'll be under.
I think it's going to be under? It's way over. 910 total votes, wow. 82% Choi, 68% by decision for the 18% that have Trezano, 82% by decision. I started this video off, Matt, by saying I've had what I thought was a really good read on both of these guys to now I have a murky read on both of these guys. They're fighting for their jobs. Who do you have to win this fight?
It's a difficult fight to predict. Yeah. There's no way around it because I do think we laid out clear paths to victory for both guys. Again, Trezano can definitely use his offensive wrestling, disguise it with some of his strikes, and I think he can have a lot of success. I definitely think Sung Woo Choi is the better striker on the feet. Like, if this was a 15-minute striking-only affair, I would favor Sung Woo Choi in that type of a matchup. But we fight in MMA. And I do think Mike Trezano, who I haven't had a great read on in the UFC up until this point. Again, I'm not a big Ultimate Fighter fan. Again, Anthony Bennett was the last time a first overall pick just completely flopped in the NBA. For Mike Trezano, there's been a lot of Ultimate Fighter winners who have not gone on to have a lot of success, but it has been a little upsetting to see a guy who won the show not have the greatest level of success in the UFC.
Like our guy Brad Katona.
It's just, it's unfortunate.
I look at this fight as Sung Woo Choi when he's that distance, when he can throw his kicks, when he can throw those nice shots. I mean, he's got such zip at the end of his punches, but I look at it for Trezano. If he can box him down, tuck his chin, as his corner says in just about every single fight, if he can toss that left hook out there, crowd the kicker, crowd the striker, and mix in a couple of those takedown attempts, I think Trezano can win this fight. So I'm going against the odds. I'm going against the fans, and both of us actually the underdog, Mike Trezano, to get the win. Let us know down below who you have in this matchup. It feels like forever I picked Sung Woo Choi to win fights, and now I'm going against him, and I'm going with Mike Trezano, a really tough one to try and get a read on. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this matchup. Giant fights in the rest of this one that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, if you account for the months, we have a combined age of 75 in the women's strawweight division. It's the former title challenger, Carolina Kovalkiewicz, taking on La Malvada. It's Argentina's own Silvana Gomez Juarez in a battle of strikers, right?
Sure.
Like Carolina Kovalkiewicz, I mean, she got her first submission win since 2014, her last fight, but she's still a striker, right?
I don't want to spill anything on your floor, but I was going to say spill one out for Coolio, because we've been spending most of our lives living in this striker's paradise. But you're right, Carolina Kovalkiewicz showed us something new. You want to take it away or you want me to talk about it?
Go for it.
Carolina, up until a certain point in her career, was only known as a Muay Thai striker. A lot of you guys will remember that. She had a very marquee matchup at UFC 205, one of the greatest UFC events of all time. The first time the UFC had ever been to Madison Square Garden, which will be nice because I do know this. Robert Hellenius, who is, he just got knocked out by Deontay Wilder. His two last wins, I forget who they were over, but they were over a Polish guy. And I know this. New York has a very large Polish population, and they really show up for their fighters. That was a big talking point when Joanna had fought Carolina, and it was really nice to see because they definitely show up for their fighters, and I do expect Carolina to have that kind of crowd support this time around in Madison Square Garden again. But her last time around, she showed us a grappling side of her game that we had yet to see, and it was surprising because with Carolina, it felt like after every loss, especially after she was on that kind of championship level, if you will, it was, oh, is she going to retire? Is she going to come back? And that's never a great conversation to hear from a fighter, and that's normally when you start predicting they're going to lose every single fight because they kind of have one foot in and one foot out. And again, normally when a fighter starts talking about retirement and they have lengthy layoffs, they rarely show you a new wrinkle in their game.
And it was one of those forced wrinkles because it was a rematch, of course, that you're talking about against Felice Herrig, the first matchup. Who got the win?
Carolina by split decision, but to be fair, she won that fight convincingly.
And in the second fight, Kovalkiewicz was having a lot of success in the striking. It was her classic Muay Thai stance. She kind of stands upright, keeps her hands up, and throws a wicked amount of volume in her fights. And she was still able to do that. Now, she does have a give one to take one type of style. She will just kind of step into the phone booth and throw. And that's where she has the most amount of her success. Now, against Jessica Andrade, pull back the curtain in that fight. Carolina tried to do that a little bit at the start of it. And Andrade just walks her forward, lands tons and tons of punches. And in that one, you had the fact that Joe Rogan compared Jessica Andrade to Wanderlei Silva with her striking.
It's pretty close, to be fair.
And yeah, I mean, Andrade is minus 500 in the fight, but that started the lengthy losing streak that Kovalkiewicz was on. Five in a row. They don't normally keep fighters around any longer, but she was able to get that winner last time out. And it was off of Herrig trying to go for a takedown, and then Kovalkiewicz turning the tables. Marcus D'Amata could have been happier to have American Top Team, but a big win there.
Could you imagine if they made UFC 4 on, like, Oculus Rift, and then you had to fight Jessica Andrade? Just the fear
Matt,
that you would feel
okay,
in your
Okay, hold on. This is the scariest part. Matt doesn't know, but you talk about Oculus what? Rift? Focus on Silvana Gomez Juarez for a second, because with her fight style, Matt, you say Oculus Rift. I say Oracular Spectacular. He didn't know this! The MGMT album, because when you look at it for Silvana Gomez Juarez, I'm scared right now. It's kind of like the one song, and you know where I'm going with it. And it's difficult to win unless you're bored, and you might have to plan for the weekend wars, because for Silvana Gomez Juarez, her opponent the last time out looks a little bored with her striking, and Liang Na, or Na Liang,
And Gomez Juarez threw the weekend war on her, knocked her out in the first round, and she knocked her out like few women will at the strawweight division. It is kind of wild, but that's the thing I keep on going back to with Silvana Gomez Juarez. I have a hard time seeing her having that level of success in her striking against top-level female strawweights in the UFC. Now, could she do it against Carolina Kowalkiewicz, who I'm still not completely sold on? Yes, she could, because Carolina's last win over Felice Herring still isn't the most convincing win of her career. It doesn't completely erase her past losses. Felice Herring's another fighter who had a lot of question marks surrounding her, was not at the best point of her career.
Promptly retired at the end of the fight, too.
Exactly, so it's not like she beat prime Felice Herring, if there ever was one. So, for Gomez Juarez, I still think she can have success in this matchup, but it really does come down to, where is Carolina in her career? Did she just lose a lot of fights in a row to good fighters, and it was a bad stretch in her career? Or is she trying to kind of re-piece together the fighter that she once was? I will say this, though. It is very surprising to see both these fighters similar in age, because normally when we talk about both these fighters, they are much older than their opponents are, and this will not be the case this time.
And you look at this one and you'd say for Kowalkiewicz, well, if she strikes, she's going to struggle, because Gomez Juarez, what does she do? She pumps a jab out there, fighting out of Entram Gym in Mexico. She really throws the overhand right, and she throws a little bit of a leg kick. That's the game right there. She's not going to go for offensive takedowns. She's not going to try and grapple in the matchup. And for Carolina Kowalkiewicz, in the UFC since debuting years ago, two takedowns. One against Jodi Esquibel that meant nothing. There was no control time out of it at all. And one against Jessica Penne that led to her getting submitted. So for Kowalkiewicz, she doesn't go for takedowns. Maybe this is the matchup. For Gomez Juarez, again, jab, overhand right, jab, overhand right. Little bit of a leg kick. Low volume, high power versus the high power volume of Kowalkiewicz. And I just mean that because she throws a ton of volume at the opponent, even as her career's gone on. So we look at the odds here. Kowalkiewicz open a minus 170 favorite, minus 116. Gomez Juarez open plus 145, minus 108. So slight underdog, Gomez Juarez, slight favorite, Carolina Kowalkiewicz. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 60% Kowalkiewicz.
I think it's going to be over.
I think it's going to be over. It's the opposite way. 910 wow. Total votes, 65% Gomez Juarez, 39% by decision, 53% by knockout. For the 35% that have Kowalkiewicz, 71% by decision. Matt, five-fight losing streak, you win one, you look good. Performance bonus for Gomez Juarez, her last time out, and it should be noted, her fight against Vanessa Demopoulos does that exact same thing. Overhand right, drops her, then goes right into the guard to promptly get submitted, which is going to happen. Performance bonus for Demopoulos. Jumps into the arms of Joe Rogan. The internet's never the same. But Matt, you look at this matchup. What's the pick here?
I hate the pick no matter what it is.
Is it pop and popcorn, would you say?
100%. Do not put your hard-earned money on this fight, for the love of God. It is not worth it. I have Carolina Kowalkiewicz, and this is why. Again, doesn't feel good making that pick whatsoever. But if she doesn't get knocked out, I do think her volume is going to win out in this fight. I do like her activity for the most part. And again, if the fight does hit the mat, I don't love Carolina against a lot of fighters in the grappling department. I'm not just going to buy into her last submission win against Felice Herring, because I do think she's going to struggle against a lot of people who do have kind of that wrestling base or even a jiu-jitsu base. But Gomez Juarez isn't some phenom on the mat herself. So I think this is a rare matchup where Carolina's going to have not an advantage, but at least have the volume on her side to where if she doesn't get finished, she should be able to win rounds. And again, I don't love Carolina against the majority of fighters on the ground, but I think this is one of those unique matchups where Carolina can have success on the mat, so I'll pick Kowalkiewicz to look good in this one.
If you had an MGMT reference to probably, like, the lesser listened to song on side A of this record had Time to Pretend, The Youth, Electric Feel, and Kids.
Dude,
and I went with Weekend Wars. I've got Silvana Gomez Juarez in the most heavyweight strawweight fight you've ever seen in your life. I think that the power is going to beat the volume of Kowalkiewicz, which I don't normally do. I think Kowalkiewicz has more tools in the tool belt. I think the ATT training could definitely win it out for her. Marcus D'Amata is a great coach, and I think Kowalkiewicz has a great chance in this one. I like that 1-2 for Gomez Juarez, and it's different than with Jessica Andrade, because Andrade closed distance with hooks and pressured, whereas Gomez Juarez is jab with an overhand right. But I will go with Gomez Juarez to get the win. We're split on the pick. Matt going with Kowalkiewicz. I'm going with Argentina's own La Malvada to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Do you like MGMT, or do you think they're overrated? Has Matt watched The Big Lebowski yet?
Not yet.
Yeah, I watched it again last night, and I'm not even joking. Oh, after the God, fights, Chris. I watched it. I love that movie. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
He's gone. He's no longer a UFC fighter, and he's not fighting tonight.
So he's been cut from the UFC off the back of that.
Yep.
Coming up this weekend at lightweight, a fight almost 2 years in the making, the UFC's own version of Don Rickles with Toy Story. We have Mr. Potato, Otman Zaitsev, taking on Matt Frivola. It's the Steamrolla versus the Bulldozer.
Hear me out.
Yeah?
Is Matt Frivola just Jason Witt from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
I mean, I don't know about that.
It's pretty close, though. He, not like down to the size of an ant, but you take 15 pounds off him, boom, we're in business.
Matt Frivola, I mean, coming in off a giant win over Renato Valdez his last time out. He looked amazing. Dropped him umpteen different times. I counted 6 knockdowns. The UFC didn't, but couldn't regardless, Matt Frivola looked amazing in that fight, but we got to reel it back in a little bit. We talked about this fight 2 years ago. I think you folks are going to enjoy this. We're going to throw it back to the breakdown.
We look different.
From 2 years ago, we look different. The studio's different. Let's throw it on back to the original breakdown, and then we'll update you with all of the particulars because a lot's different since that. Two great fighters. One in Morocco's Otman Zaitsev. The nickname's the Bulldozer, taking on Matt, the Steamroller Frivola, out of the great old U.S. of A. And Matt, for Matt Frivola, if he's going to set things up, really has to go with a wrestling-heavy offense. You look at his last 2 wins against primary strikers, Jalen Turner, and a really tough out in Luis Pena. And while they consider that one a split decision win, I don't know what one of the judges was thinking, because for Matt Frivola, he put on a great fight in that one. And if you look at Otman Zaitsev,
he got dropped in every round.
He could drop, but his wrestling worked. And if you look at Otman Zaitsev, undefeated at 13-0, his 2 UFC fights, a knockout of Teemu Pakalin, and Kama Worthy. And Matt, I remember our narrative going into the fight between Zaitsev and Kama Worthy, the fact that Worthy throws a lot of straight shots down the middle. They could disrupt the rhythm of Otman Zaitsev, who throws with a lot of power. And he has a lot of different kind of styles to his fighting. And he's a master of sport in Thai boxing. He has great power. Obviously, we've seen that through his undefeated run. And Teemu Pakalin, a win over him doesn't tell you anything. Teemu Pakalin's UFC run was meager, I guess.
People know him for being on 2 different guys' highlight reels. That'd be a Zaitsev and Gekasey. So not really what you want to be known for in a UFC run.
It's difficult. But in this fight, very interesting. Contrasting styles meeting in the middle. For Matt Frivola coming in, you know, he had a great win on Contender Series. He had the loss to Polo Reyes in his debut. And if you look at the overall Tapology prediction, 643 of them, 90% going as Zaitsev. 85% having to win by knockout. We've seen that done. And in the Polo Reyes fight against Matt Frivola, he knocks him down with almost the first punch. And then Matt Frivola is just trying to clear the cobwebs for the rest of it. And then Polo ends it.
So Matt Frivola is a really interesting character. And you know a lot more about heavy machinery than I do. I don't really know what would win out between a bulldozer and a steam roll up. But Matt
Frivola, I take a bulldozer, depending on the size.
Okay, perfect. So for Matt Frivola, though, he does really like to incorporate his wrestling into his game. And it's, the wrestling is the foundation, and a lot of the time when you talk about a wrestle boxer, they use their hands to then set up their wrestling, whereas for Vola, it feels like it's the opposite. He really needs the takedown for his stand-up to have success, because on the feet, he's very basic, and I don't mean that in a negative way. He just doesn't do a lot of crazy techniques. It's just jabs and straights, not even really a lot of kicking game either, just I know what I'm good at, and I'm going to stick to that. Over at Otman Zaitsev, though, I don't think I've ever been more impressed. I can't say that. That's such a huge statement. I've definitely been more impressed in my life. But Zaitsev's run in the UFC to this point has been very impressive.
And 2 fights.
2 fights, I know. But you can't have Teemu Pakalin and look any better. And yes, we talk about people's opponents. It matters how you beat them, though. And the fact that he was able to go out there and just start with one punch was very impressive. The Kama Worthy fight is interesting because I was never that high on Kama Worthy until the Otman Zaitsev fight. And I was like, damn, Kama Worthy at 155, he's durable, he's got good boxing, switch stances. Like, wow, what isn't there to like about him? And then Otman Zaitsev, I don't know if his one goal that day was to prove me wrong, but boy, did he. His boxing is absurd. And it's not just the boxing technique, it's not just the Muay Thai. His hand speed is something that cannot be undermined. He's got phenomenal strikes. He goes to the body too. And it's something that we saw a lot in the Holloway.
If you watch that finish in the Kama Worthy fight, he rocks him. And then when Worthy goes back, he goes almost like Max Holloway in the fight against Calvin Kattar, just straight up to the body until Worthy kind of drops down, and then he starts going to the head again.
It's very Ilia Topuria-esque when you look back at just sort of recent finishes in that aspect. He's not a guy we don't see a lot in MMA. Left hooks to the body are really good. Stipe Miocic proved that against Daniel Cormier. And the people who use them, like the really high-level boxing in MMA, they always have great success. Zaitar is one of those guys who, he might not have a number next to his name, but some of the skills that he shows kind of prove that he will be at that point. At one point in his career, I can almost guarantee you Upman Zaitar will be ranked. That's the high regard I hold him in. I like how active his hips are, too. We talk about that a lot when we talk about Piotr Jan. But with Jan, he might not be the best grappler in the world, just when you look at it credentials-wise. But in MMA, the fact that the second you even think about a takedown on Jan, his hips are either down or they're away. He's not going to play around with that range a lot with you. For Vola, basically, like, that's all he wants to do. So for Zaitar, if he can keep his back off the cage and just really force this fight, I'm not even going to say disengage in the wrestling completely. It's definitely not the best idea, but if he is involved in some wrestling transitions, I wouldn't worry that much about it. I would just really need to make sure that Zaitar can hold the center of the cage. If he's not getting backed up to the cage where Frivola can... And Frivola won't even be getting a lot of takedowns from the cage. It's sort of the frustrating thing about his style. It's, I'm going to take you down, then you're going to work your way back up to your feet, then I'll trip you again, and it's just sort of... It's a style that's going to break your will more than any of your bones. And for Zaitar, the exact opposite. Like, he's going out there to finish you, where for Frivola, he's going out there to win.
All right, so we reel it back in, Matt. New studio, Poop, different look. Same guys, though, but you focus in on this fight. So Zaitar out due to potato gate. In steps Armin Tsarukyan, because Tsarukyan was supposed to fight Nasrat Haqparast on that card. Haqparast out, Zaitar out. It's like a fight, like, on the regional scene. They just throw guys together. Frivola fights Armin Tsarukyan. Frivola in that fight, plus 480 as a dog. Wow. Lost that fight, got ground out. No shame in that one. Then he goes out there and fights Terrence McKinney. He was a minus 205 favorite in that one. We picked him to win that fight. McKinney knocked him out in 10 seconds. So then Frivola goes out and fights Renato Valdez. Knocks him dead about 8.5 months ago. Looked amazing in that fight. I have to say this, though. He looked amazing in that fight. I don't take anything away from him. I don't think Renato Valdez is a UFC fighter. My question to you, Matt. Amin Zaitar hasn't competed since he beat Kama Worthy years ago. But the point is, have you gained much from Matt Frivola losing to McKinney, losing to Tsarukyan, beating Renato Valdez in that time span where Zaitar has been away?
Not a lot, I don't think, because I do feel like his skill set still is the same if you look at the foundation of it. His striking is still somewhat basic. I don't know.
I think he was a banshee his last time out.
Against a guy who you admittedly said was not at the UFC level. You're right. He did look better, but you have to understand who he looked better against. Like, Kevin Durant just broke Daniel Gafford's ankles. It's not like he broke Mikhail Bridges' ankles. Like, there's levels to this. For Matt Frivola, you're right. He did look like his striking was better, but it takes a lot more than against a guy like Valdez for me to really buy into those improvements that you have made on the feet. I think Frivola is, like what I said at the start of the video, he does share some similarities with a guy like Jason Witt. You're going to worry about him when he fights a genuine power puncher, because we have seen him struggle with real power threats on the feet, especially at the UFC level.
And in the UFC, for Frivola, dropped twice by Polo Reyes, dropped twice by Lando Venata, and dropped by Terrence McKinney.
And I feel like he got hurt by Luis Pena too. I don't know if he got dropped by him, but he was definitely hurt on multiple occasions. My point with Frivola is he just has very obvious strengths and very obvious weaknesses. His striking is effective but still somewhat basic. He has a very good wrestling game, and I do like his wrestling cardio too, because I do think you have to split cardio into two different factions. You have striking cardio and wrestling cardio. Look at a guy like Israel Adesanya. He has great cardio if he can keep the fight on the feet, because he's used those muscles so often. But then look at him in the fight against Jan Blachowicz when he's defending takedowns, trying to get up from the bottom. He is starting to wear the fatigue on him much more than when he is able to fight at his own pace. And for Matt Frivola, when he's getting into those wrestling heavy exchanges, he can look good pretty late, even if he is fighting at a very high pace. And that's the one thing I've always really liked out of Frivola. But against a guy like Zaitar, who does throw with such heavy power in his feet, and he can throw power, especially defending guys' takedowns, I think this is one of those really black and white fights for Matt Frivola, where he could look really good until he doesn't, and that's what makes this fight really difficult to predict.
For Zaitar, two fights in the UFC, the one against Teemu Pakalin, the one against Kama Worthy, both guys no longer with the promotion, but regardless, two first-round knockouts, two performance bonuses. Craziest part, though, over a two-year layoff for Zaitar. He hasn't fought more than once a year since 2017. So a lot of inactivity for Zaitsev, 32 years old right now. This is the part that you didn't see at the start of the video when we threw it back to the old studio about 2 years ago. First time this fight was booked, Zaitsev was a minus 160 favorite. That's a 61.5% implied percentage. And if you look at it, 90% of 829 Tapology voters had a Zaitsev to win.
Really?
Since that time, Frivola has lost twice to Armin Zarukian, Terrence McKinney, and he beat Renato Valdez. So it's kind of all over the map. Exactly. We look at the odds today. Frivola open plus 105, minus 117 is the favorite. Zaitsev open minus 125, minus 106, the slight underdog. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. So 90% the first time had a Zaitsev.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised they were that high.
The odds have flipped. And again, we both had a Zaitsev to beat Frivola the first time. I'm going to say over under 70% Frivola. And I think it's a little bit Benito Lopez, Mario Bautista.
I think it's going to be under.
You think it's going to be under 70%? It's
way under.
Who are these people? 933 total votes, 88% as Zaitsev, 85% by knockout for the 12% that are Frivola, 46% by decision, and 29% who only saw him fight Renato Valdez by knockout. So, Matt, the fans have a Zaitsev. The odds have Frivola. We had a Zaitsev the first time, but he hasn't fought since before Potato Gate. Yeah. So, who do you have this weekend?
I don't love the fact that I'm still picking Ottman, but I am still picking him in this matchup. I just think with Frivola, he could win every minute of this fight until minute 14, 30 seconds. And then all of a sudden, he gets hit by a really big shot and goes down. It's not that I don't like the skill set out of Frivola. It's just when you have these wrestlers who are so dominant with their wrestling, but they don't have the highest probability to finish. And you match that along with the fact that Matt Frivola is not the most durable guy in the world. I think it does leave an area where Ottman can look really bad early on, kind of suffer some of those mistakes, get some of that ring rust off him, and then look good later on in the fight. Or he can go out there and get another first-round knockout like he's been able to do in the UFC up until this point. I don't love the pick because, again, I think there's a world where Frivola goes out there, really uses his wrestling and his pace, especially matched along with the wrestling, to have a lot of success against Ottman. But I am still going to pick a Zaitsev in this fight.
I think Zaitsev has a good camp and a good foundation as far as defending the takedowns, working the striking. You look at it, less than a handful of his wins are by knockout after round number one. Majority are in round number one. And if you consider it with his brother, long periods of inactivity, fights Marc-Andre Barrio. At the start looks good, and then his cardio fell off a cliff. Now, his brother is older, but at the same time, you know, not all brothers are the same. So I guess I do still have Ottman Zaitsev in this one. Over the 2 years, Frivola losing the two fights, beating Renato Valdez, hasn't changed my mind all that much, but we could see a level up from Frivola, especially after that last win. And for Zaitsev, we'll see if the ring rust still progresses. Matt, we're going with the underdog in the matchup, both of us going with the Zaitsev to get the win. Really eager to hear your thoughts on this one down below in the comments section, especially with the Potato Gate. Really eager to see the rest of the fights on this card. It's an absolute banger. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
The prodigy.
Middleweight finishers squaring off in the prelims, UFC 281. We have Renzo Gracie, Philly's own. Andre Petroski has made his personal brand focused around the hammer and sickle logo. That's problematic. Taking on, you heard it in the intro, the prodigy Wellington Turman. So you got to think about it before you say it. But for Wellington Turman's last time out, he's taking on Misha Cirkunov. Now, this is a guy with a Peruvian necktie win in the UFC to Cirkunov. And Cirkunov at the start actually struggled with Turman. Turman was in a lot of advantageous positions. He got the back quickly. You thought he was going to get the win. And then at about the 2.5 minute mark to the 2 minute mark, Misha Cirkunov said, nah, dice. I'm going to just take over in this one. And he brutalized Turman. Almost had him finished by an anaconda choke. Andre Petroski knows those very well. But Cirkunov had tons of success. There was even a point in that first round where Bisping goes, he's unconscious! And then they're like, no, Michael, he's not. And then he had to reel it back in like Mike Goldberg with the prodigy, whatever it was. But if you look at it for Turman, second round, it's more of the same from Cirkunov, brutalizing him. And then he throws up a Hail Mary armbar. And boy, does he ever rip that guy's arm off. So
got him.
Turman goes out there, gets a performance bonus with a giant comeback. The win that he has before that, a split decision over Sam Alvey. Couple losses before that. One to Bruno Silva, former training partner. And then, of course, to El Dierte Andrew Sanchez, former Ultimate Fighter winner. But for Wellington Turman, nice record to look at on a page. Still young in the game. And for Turman, I think either the worst days are to come or the best days. I don't think it's going to be middling. It's one or the other.
The weird thing with Turban is he is a well-rounded fighter who does have good jiu-jitsu, but it feels like he's a very wide fighter on the feet. Let me explain that. He doesn't really cut through the fat and get from point A to point B. It's not just a straight line. I do feel like there is room for his opponents to counter him a lot on the feet. Now, we have seen that, especially in the UFC level. He has been finished a number of times, but for Turban, it does feel like he is hittable, especially in some of these fights. And if he's not able to really threaten with some of his wrestling, especially the grappling side of it, I do think some of the upper echelon strikers can get a hold of him at a certain point.
Now, looking at it, for Turman, he's formerly of Gile Ribeiro team down in Brazil. You've known Augusto Sakai out of that camp. There's been multiple UFC fighters out of that camp. He switched it up getting ready at Teixeira MMA before, what was it, his third to last fight. It was his fight where, like, Bruno Silva, Sam Alvey, and Misha Cirkunov. So those three fights, he's been training with Teixeira. And if you look at Turman when he's standing up, I disagree a little bit. I agree and I disagree. He will go in straight. He will throw straight shots. He will get countered and he will get hit. His striking defense struggles a lot. Even though he goes right down, his head always stays on the center line and that's where he's left to get hit.
And I do think it's a bit of a lack of speed too on his part. If you do have sort of upper echelon hand speed, you can slip some of his punches and counter effectively. With a guy like Petrosky, who isn't the most volume heavy guy on the feet without a doubt, he does have incredible power. Like, that's the one thing that really stands out about Andre Petrosky. He's incredibly physically strong, especially for this weight class, even in the middleweight division. Like, there's some big guys at middleweight, but Petrosky does stand out. I know he's only 6 feet tall. There's a lot of guys who are 6 feet tall in this weight division, but when you watch him fight, that definitely is a part of his style that he likes to accentuate. And I'll be curious to see if Turman can have success in the grappling department against a guy like Petrosky, because we know how good Andre is, especially in that top position. I'll be curious to see if Turman can get the separation, especially from that bottom, to threaten with a submission, get back up to his feet, just to be a real threat off of his back if the fight does find itself there.
And for Petrosky, you look at it, I mean, 7-1 as an amateur, 8-1 as a pro. It's a tidy little record. And you look at it, the only loss to a pro, Taron Jeffrey, succeeded at the start, dwindled as the fight went on. Fight against Brian Battle in The Ultimate Fighter, exact same deal. And he ends up getting finished in both of those fights. But in the UFC for Petrosky, you look at the fights, beats Michael Gilmore. Gilmore rallied back in the second round, had a lot of success with the striking. But Petrosky round one, round three, ends up getting the finish. He fights Hu Yao Zhang on week's notice. Old Totoro, love the anime, but for Totoro, who's 3-2, who started off in the UFC at heavyweight against Cyril Asker, and ended in middleweight, Petrosky looked great. He was a plus 200 underdog against Nick Maximov, recently released Nick Maximov, and he gets that win by Anaconda, and he looked really good in that fight. He was throwing the hammers at the start, he was getting hit by the body kick, but he ended up defending the single leg, which is the Maximov staple,
exactly.
Defends it, cranks for the submission, rolls, it wasn't once, but twice. He had a couple of spots where he rolled for the Anaconda, gets the win, and I listened to an interview that he did with James Lynch that just came out, Lynch MMA, and he touched on the fact that for this camp, he's been training with Sonny Kanto, the boxer, and I looked at Sonny Kanto's boxer rec, 11-0, just fought recently,
pretty good
record. Contract status was in the headline, so I continued to listen. He was hoping for a new contract after his last win. Didn't seem happy that he didn't get a new contract. Switch management after his last fight. His manager now, and I love it, Tiki Gosen. And this is manager now. The familiarity from The Ultimate Fighter. Tiki was a coach with Brian Ortega. So that's his manager now, hoping for a new contract after the Wellington Turman fight. But how do they not give it to him? Like 3-0 already in the UFC. He's got finishes on his record as well. He's looked very good. He's exceeded my expectations. I got to say that too. With Petrosky, I was always worried about the cardio because he throws hammers on the feet. He'll throw and then duck out of the way. And if you're taking on a good striker, you're going to get countered. You're going to get hit.
100%.
Hasn't happened to him yet, except for the second round against Michael Gilmore. And then if you consider it with his takedown attempts, I mean, he was a three-time state qualifier in high school wrestling. Earned a full ride scholarship at UNC Chapel Hill for wrestling. He does, of course, train at Team Daniel Gracie. Now, damn Daniel, they were on top of the world for a while.
They were.
And Pat Sabatini lost, and Sean Brady lost.
Yeah.
So Petrosky's looking to pick him back up again. So I'm eager to see what we get out of Petrosky in the matchup. We look at the odds here. Petrosky open minus 190 favorite, minus 213. Turman open plus 165, plus 173. Matt, we have a look at the Tapology votes, and honestly, I have no idea where they are. So I'm going to say over under 70% Petrosky.
I think they'll be over.
I think they're going to be over. They're way over. 907 total votes, 86% Petrosky, 30% by decision, 29% by submission, 36% by knockout. That doesn't add up. For the 14% that have Thurman, 33% by decision, 40% by submission. So majority of the fans have Petrosky. The odds, Petrosky. Matt, Petrosky?
I do like Petrosky in this fight. I like his ability to threaten with his wrestling, and I do like his overall striking. You're right. Is it clubbing? Is it somewhat unorthodox? Yes, it is. But when you have the power that Andre Petrosky possesses in his hands, you can get away with making some mistakes because you can make the wrongs right if you do end up landing some of those power shots. And it wasn't that long ago that Sam Alvey was able to land some pretty clean shots at a guy like Wellington Turman, and Sam Alvey's not necessarily in the prime of his career. So I do like Petrosky in this matchup, but I will admit this. I think the volume of Turman can give him trouble, especially if this fight does go to a decision. I do think Turman can stay steady enough throughout three rounds to at least make this fight compelling if he's not taken down for any large portions of the fight. So I do think there's a world where Turman's able to win, but I do like Petrosky in this fight.
For Turman, I mean, as a young guy, he struggled with cardio in the UFC. The Sam Alvey fight and the fight against Maluco Marcus Perez, a guy whose cardio has not been good, UFC or otherwise. And for Petrosky, I have those same questions, but I do like the motor, as cliche as that's going to sound. And I'm going to say another cliche thing. I love the fact that he's been competing at these CFFC Fury grappling tournaments.
That's a good point.
Beats Phil Hawes by decision, and I went back and watched that before Petrosky's last fight, and then he submitted Eric Anders his last time out. So I do really like that out of Petrosky. I know he's maybe not to the same level as Turman, maybe with the grappling, but I do think it's close. I do prefer the looping shots to the straight shots. I'm never going to say that, but yeah, in this one, I actually do. So I will go with Andre Petrosky to get the win, flipping the poles of the odds. His last time out, plus 200 against Maximo. This time out, more than a 2-1 favorite. Both of us going with Petrosky to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Compelling matchups throughout this card. This one at middleweight, your title fight up at the top. It's a trilogy at middleweight. Pereira taking on Adesanya. I can't wait for it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Top 15 women's flyweight squaring off at MSG. Coming up this weekend, we have Barstool Sports Zone Meatball Molly McCann taking on cold-blooded Erin Blanchfield, the 23-year-old phenom, who's getting a little bit of a hometown feel for this fight. She represents Henzo Gracie's there in New York. And for Blanchfield, the lone loss on that record, a very chintzy split decision to Tracy Cortez. You go back and watch that fight, you make your own assumptions and assessments. But if you look at it for Blanchfield in the UFC, it's been nothing but wins. She's like DJ Khaled. And if you do consider it too, outside of the UFC, a lot of very, very nice wins to go along for Blanchfield. I mean, you go down through the record, win over Kay Hansen, a win over Victoria Leonardo, and a win over Ultimate Fighter finalist Brogan Walker, all outside of the UFC, exactly, with Invicta. Wins over Sarah Alpar, Miranda Maverick, and JJ Aldrich. And Blanchfield was quite a heavy favorite against Alpar and against Aldrich, and a slight underdog when she went in to take on Miranda Maverick. Looked really good in that fight, outgrappled the grappler, and you know how good Maverick looked last weekend with her grappling. But for Blanchfield, if you just look at her last fight, you just look at it as a win on the page against JJ Aldrich, you can draw your assumptions there. She struggled mightily with everything until she got that deep standing guillotine where it was elbow in, elbow down, cranking up, and she got the tap. She struggled in every facet of that fight.
I agree 100%. And that's
time out. I don't know why I pronounced it facet. It's facet, but
I'm
sorry.
Okay, I'm glad you addressed it because I thought it was weird too, and I didn't say anything.
Okay.
Erin Blanchfield is a lot like Sean Brady before he has struggled with some of the upper echelon talents. But that is the weird thing about Blanchfield. Is it better to almost get a loss to Molly McCann on your record now so you realize what you have to work on as you do progress through your career? Because we talk about this with fighters who are 21, 22, 23 all the time. It's, hey, you look at the 6 months they have in between every fight, they level up multiple times in between every single fight. That doesn't happen when you're 31, 32, 33. So for Blanchfield, she's still in that period where she can make those big leaps in between every single fight. So it almost would be nice for her to kind of suffer that defeat for her to try to rework some parts of her game. But if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And for Erin Blanchfield, her offensive grappling has been so dominant up until this point that even with the Miranda Maverick matchup, that was the conversation. It was, hey, Miranda Maverick's a pretty good offensive grappler too. We know how good a ground and pound is, how damaging she can be. Erin Blanchfield looked really good with her own wrestling. Now, to be fair, Blanchfield was a lot bigger at like physically than Miranda Maverick in that fight. And I don't know if she's going to have that same luxury physically against someone like Molly McCann. But McCann is a very good boxer. We know how much power she has in her hands. I know they're going to show you that spinning elbow a lot. But for
the
most part.
That spinning elbow, two in a row.
Exactly.
Two performance bonuses off them.
But for the most part, I would say Molly McCann's success, at least the sustained success in her game, comes from her boxing and her offensive wrestling too. I know you talked about Brad Riddell in the opening for our Fight of the Night screen, and I agree with you 100%. Brad Riddell is marketed to you as a striker, but what does he do every single fight that kind of catches you off guard? He'll go for a double leg takedown and has a lot of success with it. Molly McCann is very similar in that capacity. Offensively, she does have decent grappling, I would say, but she does struggle defensively a lot with the takedown attempt and with her own submission defense and just with her grappling defense overall. So I look at this fight very much as a water and oil kind of fight. Either Erin Blanchfield gets it down to the mat and it is all her world, it's not even close whatsoever, or Molly McCann can kind of do the unthinkable almost, defend some of those early takedowns, damage Erin Blanchfield, especially early on in the fight, to make her a little bit more tentative with going for some of those takedown attempts. And I could see Molly McCann having some success on the feet. I just think the takedown defense is going to be such a big issue for her.
Blanchfield fought a striker last time out. She was taken down by the striker and struggled with the cage pressure of Aldridge. She got countered. Listen, Monday to Sunday, it was a 9-to-5 job for her. And the trouble is,
I think Aldridge is a little bit more technical than McCann.
With Erin Blanchfield, the trouble is she throws a lot of kicks, and like, no, it's not the biggest part of her arsenal, but when you do factor it in, a lot of body kicks. And the thing that she does is, for a lot of people, grapplers, wrestlers, you're just going to go out there and you're going to shoot. For Blanchfield, she'll throw a kick to close the distance to then get her takedowns, and that's where she can get countered by a lot of strikers. She also, when she goes to strike, she'll get into the phone booth and then square up and drop her hands, and that's where Molly McCann can take over. And for McCann, she's fought fighters like Blanchfield in the past. She's had varied levels of success. The last time McCann fought a ranked opponent, she fought the 15th. She was 15th ranked, and she was taking on Tyla Santos. She was a favorite in that fight. It was the last time I used Lock of the Night. I said, Molly McCann, mark it, Lock of the Night. I also said, Mark Jacasey, lock it. He's going to beat Rafael Fiziev. Same card.
Hey, we're wrong sometimes.
Got both of those ones wrong. But when I do look at this one, Matt, you consider it for McCann. This is wild. 127 significant strikes in a fight of the night against Jeon Kim. One leg kick. Her fight against Luana Carolina, 85 significant strikes before she finished it, 5 leg kicks. Her fight against Hannah Goldie, 24 significant strikes.
It's a Dan Henderson style.
1 leg kick. So Molly McCann, not big at all on the kicks. If she's a better wrestler than her opponent, better grappler, she will wrestle. If not, it's just boxing. But boxing to set up the wrestling, it's great. She's looked amazing in these last 3 fights against lower levels of competition in the division. Jeon Kim, really close fight. Could have gone either way. Luana Carolina looked really good early on. Looked bad
kind
as it went on.
Bit, yeah.
And then landed that crazy shot against Hannah Goldie. It was all Molly McCann. But for Blanchfield, I wrestle with the issues of, is the striking defense going to be a problem in this one? Because if it's southpaw, again, those straight punches of J.J. Aldrich landed all day. And for Molly McCann, out of the orthodox stance, she can have a lot of success there, too.
You guys can chirp me if you want to, and I've always thought higher of J.J. Aldrich than probably the average UFC fan. I think her boxing is semi-technical, and I do think she is a decent fighter on the feet, especially with her hands. I think McCann has more power, but I think her shots are a lot more looping shots than they are kind of the crisper shots of someone like Aldrich. So I do think McCann is the better striker in this fight. Don't get me wrong. I just don't think she's going to have as much success because of her type of strikes against Blanchfield.
McCann walks down her opponents. Aldrich invites it for the counter, so.
That's a very good point, and I do think the fact that McCann is the aggressor in a lot of these matchups is going to make her more susceptible to the takedown from Blanchfield, because if McCann does start to get really hand-happy and really sit down on her punches, it's going to make Blanchfield that much more successful if she is able to duck under and really get a hold of those hips and go for a takedown attempt. Like, I think Blanchfield's kind of that 2.0 Jillian Robertson. Jillian Robertson was kind of the original really good grappler in this division when the division was very young. But we saw in the bantamweight division, after the Ronda Rouseys were no longer champion, there was kind of that second rise of the division where you had the fighters like Amanda Nunes, Juliana Pena, and the likes who are kind of at the top right now. I think Blanchfield's kind of that second version of a Jillian Robertson. Robertson is still a good grappler, don't get me wrong, but I think Blanchfield's that and that much more. So I agree with you on all of the red flags moving forward. I think there are a lot of concerns when she
I see them in this fight.
I don't know if I do, because this is the thing. I think McCann could get the finish, but I don't think she's going to get the finish. And if she's not able to get the finish, if she's taken down for, let's say, 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes in some portion of this fight, I just don't know if she's going to be able to get that time back on the feet. I could be wrong, don't get me wrong, but I think she is going to struggle defensively with the grappling.
So, Blanchfield opened a -300, she's -400. McCann opened a +375. Or sorry, Blanchfield opened -500, -400. McCann opened +375, +300. Blanchfield in her UFC career, -380 against Sarah Alpar, +125 against Miranda Maverick, -425 against JJ Aldrich. Yikes. You have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there, to you. Now listen. Molly McCann has a very large following, but Erin Blanchfield's a giant favorite, and I think the fans have her. I'm going to say over under 80% Erin Blanchfield.
I'll say under, but she'll be the favorite.
Ah, slightly under. 977 total votes, 76% Blanchfield, 78% by decision for the 24% that I'm McCann, 34% by decision, 57% by knockout. I think if Molly McCann wins, she wins by decision, and I think Erin Blanchfield beats her in this fight. I think she's going to be able to get the takedowns, and I think she's going to be able to control portions of this fight. I don't love her top game. That's what kind of lost it against Tracy Cortez, if it did. I thought Blanchfield won, but regardless, for Blanchfield, I think they can come early and often. However, she squares up in the phone booth where McCann hits a lot of her opponents. Exactly. She has good kicks, but it opens her to counters. Like, I have a lot of red flags. I hate the odds. If you go with the underdog McCann, I don't think you're a donkey at all.
Erin Blanchfield needs to watch every Marvin Vettori fight, go home and go, damn, I'll fight just like that from now on. Because I do think that is kind of the game plan for her to have a lot of success. Don't play around on the feet unless you are having a lot of success. Now, Marvin is a good striker, so it's not the best example, but you get the idea. He's just a smart guy at not eating big shots while he does go for his takedowns. Erin Blanchfield could learn a lot from that type of game plan, because you're right, she does leave herself very open with her own striking. That's always going to be a concern against some of the better strikers. Like, if Blanchfield fought Tyler Santos, it'd be a difficult fight for Erin Blanchfield. Like, yes, she could get on top and have success. I'm not completely counting her out, but on the feet, that's a very difficult matchup for her. And Santos could even have some success in the grappling. So I do think there is an evolution for Blanchfield to have, but I still like her in this fight.
You have a couple of rising fighters. McCann looking for a fourth in a row. Erin Blanchfield looking to keep that long extended win streak on the go. Both of us going with Blanchfield. Me, incredibly reluctantly, in the matchup, a big-time card at MSG this weekend, headlined by two title fights. And oh, by the way, Dustin Poirier's Fikin Michael Chandler. Get ready for that fike, folks. It should be great. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Light heavyweight is a changing, and a couple of guys that want to keep it locked in the top 15 of this division. We have the former title challenger. Did he beat the greatest
we
of all time?
Him.
I don't know. It's Dominic Reyes, the Devastator, taking on Superman. Oh, Ryan Spann. And Matt, for Ryan Spann, he's going to want to kiss you through the phone. He's going to want you to buy his video game complex thing. That's about all I have for Soulja Boy references. But for Ryan Spann, how this guy made middleweight, insane. I have no idea. And if you consider it, he was a big deal with the LFA as a very young man. He fought for the LFA middleweight championship back a number of years ago, lost to Leo Leite, you know, the grappler. And at that time, he was 24. Leo was 37. So he doesn't win the middleweight shot. Then he goes out there and he fights for the light heavyweight title. He takes on another old grappler, and he wasn't that old at the time, but Robert Drysdale. You know, the guy that owns the gym in Vegas.
The guy who trains Kevin Holland?
Yeah, he's a big deal. Well, Robert Drysdale ends up beating Ryan Spann, so Spann has to go back to the drawing board. Fights on Dana White's Contender Series. The old Achilles heel. Before it was known as that, Carl Robertson, I'm going to land those elbows.
Yikes.
When I'm trying to get the takedown, or when you're trying to get the takedown. Goes back with the LFA. Fights for the title one more time. It's the third title opportunity. Fights Alex Nicholson. Nicholson had already been in the UFC. Ryan Spann said, I'm finally winning the title. And he did. So a big win for Ryan Spann there. Alex Nicholson then went on to beat off a guy on Cam Soda.
What did he do?
Beat off a legend. Former UFC heavyweight champ, Rico Rodriguez.
Wow.
Just beat him off on a paid website that's got smut on it.
Did you spend the money on it?
Not on that fight. Wow. No. That was that Cam Soto Legends
Craig
card.
Craig spent money to watch Rico Rodriguez beat off.
No, but I will tell you what. I did watch Cam Soto for one of those Fight Circus cards. So that was
I'm
fun.
I'm sure that's what you told your wife when the credit card bill came in. This fight is a very interesting one, though, because for Dominic Reyes, is he really like the prince that was promised in the 205-pound division? Because it was wild and it wasn't that long ago that he was that hyped up of a prospect in this division where he had knocked out Chris Weidman. And that is the weird thing. It's weird to get a title shot at 205 beating Chris Weidman.
Whoa, what weight class was it at?
Yeah, 205 pounds. The one Chris Weidman never fought at until he fought Dominic Reyes. Now, again, I don't want to completely discredit that win because it was a very impressive first round knockout against the former champion. But Chris Weidman wasn't in his prime, I think that's fair to say. And that was a weight class he had never competed in. And it's not like he was champion in that weight class, like he was at middleweight. So for Dominic Reyes, it was weird for him to finally get to that title shot. And to be fair, the Volkan Oezdemir fight was a fight that a lot of people had down the middle. It was a fight that some people had for Oezdemir, some people had for Reyes. It was close. And I know this is something that people are going to roll their eyes at. It's something Reyes gets made fun of for. It's, hey, he was a really good athlete. But that is one of the things that stands out in his fighting style. He is a very athletic fighter. He does have good wrestling. He does have a very high work rate. And he's someone who does go out there and get after it. I have a lot of questions about the amount of damage he's eaten, especially in his last two fights. And to be fair, there were quotes that Dominic Reyes had even come out and said, hey, I need to give my body a little bit of time to heal. I have had some very difficult fights, and I just need to give my brain a little bit of time off. And that's a really nice thing to hear from a fighter, because how many times do we hear from fighters like, I don't bring this up to poke fun or anything, but think about a guy like Bigfoot Silva, who it feels like every time we hear about him, he's in the headlines for all the wrong reasons. Hey, he's fighting this fighter, he's getting stopped. It's nice to see Dominic Reyes take the time off that I do feel like he needs, and I think this is a good fight for him to come back to against Ryan Spann.
And Reyes getting the opportunity to switch up his camp, and that's kind of weird. Him going from California, he's had his brothers in his corner in the past, brother Alex in the UFC at one point, but for Reyes, Teixeira MMA and fitness, and listen, he's standing next to Alex Pereira, and they're the same height, so it says, but Pereira looks taller and bigger than Reyes, even though he's a weight class smaller. But for Reyes, definitely getting a good look over there. Now, with Pereira, he's going to walk you down, he's going to throw snappy leg kicks, he's going to throw the hooks. For Ryan Spann, he'll throw some kicks, but not many. He really does double up, triple up on his jab, and he has a laser right hand, and he's got a lot of speed in it, a lot of power. But if you hit Ryan Spann, you can cause him all sorts of issues. And I went through and, again, I watched a lot of Reyes tape. And if you look at the fight that he had against John Jones, a lot of people thought, okay, Reyes wins the first three, Jones wins the last two. I thought Reyes won round one, round three, Jones won round two, Jones won four, won five. 14-7 had it for Reyes on MMA decisions out of the voters. But the judges and Joe Solis, who scored at 49-46 Jones, I don't know what fight he watched. He was way off the board.
The rounds were close, though, and that's my problem. You can have weird scorecards, but a lot of the rounds are close.
Joe Solis had a lot of weird scorecards in the past.
No, no, I know. I just,
with MMA.
For Reyes and Jones, a lot of those rounds were very close, though. It's not like either guy really differentiated themselves, got a knockdown, got a big takedown or anything. So a lot of those rounds were very close. It was a fight where, honestly, if you want to have it 4-1 for Reyes, I'm not going to disagree with you. If you want to have it 4-1 for Jones, I'm not going to, because the rounds were so tightly contested. Now, I thought Reyes did do enough in that fight. I was a little bit surprised to see John Jones coming out on the winning side, and I hate that old cliche, to win the title, you gotta go out there and take it from the champ. No, you don't. You know what you gotta do? You gotta win 3 of the 5 rounds. That's it. You gotta do the same as every other MMA fighter. And to Reyes' credit, I thought he did. But the problem is, he didn't get his moment of glory, and unfortunately he did have to fight two of the more damaging strikers in the 205-pound division, and he was on the losing side of both those fights. And not just the losing side, he ate a lot of damage in those fights.
And we know that. I mean, Reyes, before these three losses in a row, he was 12-0 as a pro, 5-0 as an amateur. He never tasted defeat. He loses to Jones. Predictably, you assume he's going to beat the older guy in Blachowicz.
He was a big favorite.
Blachowicz threw a crazy combo, punctuated it with uppercuts. His fight against Yuri Prochazka, the elbow, I mean, my goodness. And if you look at Reyes, he can be the type of guy that baits you in as a southpaw, throws that. Like I said, Ryan Spann has a laser right hand because his right hand comes straight down the pipe with power and it's really quick. But Reyes throws a thudding left hand out of that southpaw stance and it really catches a lot of guys into the power. And I could see him doing that against Ryan Spann. Spann's one of those guys, like the fight that I went back to and I kept thinking of was, he gets performance of the night against Anthony Smith in his first main event with the UFC. That was a 5-round main event. Anthony Smith, he's had a 3-round main event in the past against Rockets.
I just like, you know, Dana White sitting there in his office being like, oh, we need someone to fill this main event. Who do we get? There's just Sean Shelby stands up.
It's Anthony Smith. He hits that boom box, and then automatically you have Mark Morrison playing, and it's Return to the Mac. But if you look at it from Ryan Spann, he eats a lunging left hand, and that's what causes him the trouble. Then Smith ends up getting the finish, and Smith gets up, yells at him, and people have to pick him up to get him out of the way. And Spann, earlier on in that fight, picked him up in the blue corner, picked him up in the red corner, walked him all the way to the red corner. Anthony's like, what's going on? But Ryan Spann is a good grappler, but can struggle in grappling. Leo Leite, Robert Drysdale in the UFC against Iwan Kutsalaba. Kutsalaba was going balls to the wall, dropped his head in, and got submitted. Spann is a good grappler. Spann is a good striker. Spann struggles with... I know this sounds really
stupid.
He's
good offensively, but defensively
he struggles. He can struggle defensively, and if you check his chin a couple of times, he can get on those wobbly legs. So this is a really tough fight if you're trying to make a pick on it.
Because I think that's the same point for both guys. This really is a whoever lands first is probably going to win type of fight. Because if Ryan Spann can damage Dominic Reyes early, kind of get those bad memories back into his head about his last two fights, I can see Ryan Spann having another stoppage victory on his hands. But same thing for Dominic Reyes. If he does that slide back left hand, drops Ryan Spann, I won't be surprised whatsoever.
And I would think Glover Teixeira and Alex Pereira are the perfect guys to get you ready for a fight against Ryan Spann, because Reyes already has good takedown defense and good grappling in his back pocket. The odds in this matchup: Spann opened a plus 170, is a plus 185 underdog. Dominic Reyes opened minus 195, minus 230 or thereabouts. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Dominic Reyes.
I think they'll be over.
Let's see. The palate cleanser, 1,019 total votes, 83% Reyes, 25% by decision, 67% by knockout. For the 17% that have Spann, 74% by knockout. I say the palate cleanser. Is this the palate cleanser fight? Do we forget about the bad memories of the two last losses to the two champs, Blachowicz and Prochazka? Or can Ryan Spann get the win?
It feels like every fighter on a losing streak has that one opponent where you go, okay, that's too far. Like, okay, I know they've lost a number of fights in a row, but they've lost some pretty good fighters. And to Dominic Reyes' credit, I know a lot of people like to roll their eyes. He doesn't have the most marketable personalities, maybe. Like, Dominic Reyes, for the most part, just seems like a regular guy. Like, he's not outlandish or anything like that. He's not going to go out there and get a lot of headlines. But he's a good, well-rounded fighter. And I do think the fact that he has a speed advantage, especially with his hands, is going to give Ryan Spann a lot of trouble. I do agree with you. When Spann starts to get hit, he doesn't always react in the most positive of ways. And Reyes, to his credit, was able to hurt Jury at a few points throughout their fight. The difference is, when Jury gets hurt, it just unlocks some deep demon within him, and then it really helps him become that fighter that he always can be. Whereas with Ryan Spann, I don't think he's going to become a better fighter once he does enter the firefight with a guy like Dominic Reyes. So I do expect Reyes to get back on the winning track, but the problem is, I don't really know where he goes from here. I know there's a lot of guys in 205 that he hasn't fought yet, but he's one of those tweeners right now where he was elite. He's able to have good fights with guys who are still in that elite conversation, but I guess it really does depend on how good he looks against Ryan Spann. If he goes in there, knocks him out early, maybe he'll rejoin that classification, but this will be a really important fight for both guys' careers.
Ryan Spann has a win over the brother of Antonio Rodrigo Nogueira.
He does.
I have a card here.
You can't see it in the glare of that fight.
Yeah, he looked really good in that fight. He also has a split decision win over Sam Alvey, but I consider the last few performances and the overall body of work. I like the speed out of Ryan Spann. I like the power out of Ryan Spann. I like the grappling out of Ryan Spann. And as a plus 185 underdog, and it's growing, yeah, I'll go with Ryan Spann in this matchup. So we're split on the pick. Matt going with Dominic Reyes. I'm going with the underdog that continues to grow. He's got the S on his chest, so you know.
He does.
He looks down at the weigh-ins. He doesn't like to make eye contact. I've got Spann. Matt's got the Devastator. Don't love the nickname. Big-time fights coming up this weekend. Pereira versus Adesanya. The trilogy matchup in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. With the roster swelling and new talent up and coming in a very, very dynamic lightweight division, couple of guys that are really in search of a win, we have Renato Moicano taking on Brad Quake Riddell in an absolutely amazing fight. And if you look at it, you probably think to yourself, hey, we have a striker in Brad Riddell, we have a grappler in Renato Moicano. Then you watch some fight. And it's the complete opposite. I mean, Hanato Moicano isn't a knockout artist, but he likes to set up a lot of his grappling with his boxing, and he has really good combinations, really good power. He's been checked.
Great leg kicks.
The chin has been checked a little bit, really good leg kicks. But for Moicano, it is that grappling. And even if you look into his fight against Fazeev, you go into it and the commentator, why is he deciding to trade? He had tons of success until he got caught by the body punch. It was a left hook to the body, right hook, left hook, and then it just dropped him like a sack of potatoes. But for Moicano, he was winning all of that fight until that one moment Fazeev ends up getting a ginormous win there. And if you do consider it, Matt, this is the craziest part. This is my X factor in this fight. George Hickman is in the corner of Fazeev. There was that Tiger Muay Thai connection. For Brad Riddell, he's training at a Bangtao Muay Thai, was where his camp was for this one. I know I have it at City Kickboxing because Hooker, Adesanya, Eugene Behrman's going to be there, and Ulberg. But George Hickman has been the main training partner and a main guy of Brad Riddell's corner. And if you go into Riddell and Brendan Lochnane's Instagram, those two guys are linked inextricably. So Brad Riddell really working a lot of his wrestling, his grappling to get ready for this matchup. You know him as the former head striking coach for the MMAs over at Tiger Muay Thai. And for Brad Riddell in the UFC, fight of the night against Drew Dober, that's a win. Fight of the night against Jamie Mullerkey, that's a win. He fights Magomed Mustafayev. He lands three strikes in the first round of that fight. One of them drops him. So that was crazy. He wins a split decision there. But for Brad Riddell's last two times out, takes on Rafael Fazeev, loses by knockout late into that fight, third round. Takes on Jalen Turner. Turner pours the pressure on, gets the fight down to the mat, gets the submission. You look at it for Brad Riddell, it's been a tough go his last two times out. How does he rebound? That's really the question here.
Brad Riddell's been hurt in every single one of his UFC fights. That's just fair to say. Like, I know he is a really good striker, and I know he does have the striking credentials, but he does get hit like it's going out of style, and at a certain point, that is a hole that you do have to fix. Now, at 31 years of age, he's not the oldest guy in the lightweight division. This is a division where you get into 35, 36, still have quite a bit of success, but at a certain point, we do need to see you fix some of those holes in your game, and I thought we would see some of those signs against Jalen Turner his last time out, maybe see a less reckless Brad Riddell, and I know some of that chaos is to his benefit in a lot of his fights. It helps him land his own punches. But Jalen Turner teed off on him at range and then
overhand right dropped him. Yeah.
Exactly. So for Riddell, we've seen him get hurt by Mullerkey. We've seen him get hurt in basically all of the fights except for the Mustafayev fight because Megamed's really just in there to wrestle for the most part, especially at this stage of his career, and that's what he did against Riddell. But I just worry about what Riddell's going to do in this fight if his striking isn't doing well because we know how good of a striker he is. We know how powerful of a striker he is. Hanato Moicano's outstruck Calvin Kattar in the UFC. He's outstruck Brian Ortega in the UFC, although he did get submitted at the end of that fight. He was outstriking him for large portions of the fight. He has shown the ability to just be a very technical striker and have very good volume levels on his side. Now, like you bring up, he has got his chin checked on multiple occasions throughout the UFC, and he doesn't do well against guys who throw hooks. And I know that's weird how we normally say this once every 6 months and not twice on one card, but Brad Riddell's the type of striker who does give Hanato Moicano trouble. It's weird. It's almost like really technical guys against Moicano he can have success with because, like himself, it's reached that he's very very used to, I guess, at this stage of his career. So it's nothing he doesn't expect. But the fact that Riddell almost does lead with his head and then throw the hook afterwards, I know normally that's looked at as a huge negative because you get your chin checked when you're leading with it. But if he is able to use some of that delayed time against a guy like Hanato Moicano, I think we could see him lay some of those same combinations a guy like Jose Aldo was able to do, go to the body and end up going up to the head. Because for Moicano, that is the weird thing. I think he's going to have the same problem he had at featherweight in this matchup. At featherweight, he was almost too big for the division. And I know that's a weird thing to say, but he has a very high guard with his boxing defense, and it makes his body very open. Brad Riddell can go to the body with his own striking combination, so I think with Riddell, he almost might be like a Julian Arosa. You can knock him out early, but if he gets into the fight a little bit and can get warmed up into the fight, then he becomes a much more difficult ask. And I think if this does become kind of one of those fight of the night style fights, it does start to favor a guy like Brad Riddell. But I just think, okay, if he's having success in the striking, that's great. I definitely favor Moicano with the wrestling, and I definitely favor Moicano with the grappling. I think there's a world where Moicano could have success with his own striking, though, too. And if that's the case, what the hell does Brad Riddell do as a plan B?
Well, and Riddell will wrestle. And we've seen that in the UFC.
Is Moicano the guy, though?
Riddell's weird X factor, the George Hickman, Frank Hickman comp, is the fact that if you look at his UFC fights, Brad Riddell will wrestle in the fights that he wins, and that's the craziest part. He's known as a pure striker, but you look at it, he beats Drew Dober, takes him down 5 times. He takes down Alex Da Silva. He takes down Jamie Mullarkey. Now, he did get taken down in those fights as well. But the craziest part for me, Matt, is we talk about Brad Riddell with the reverence. He's only been the favorite in 2 of his UFC fights. Really? He's, what, 4-2 in the UFC?
That's not good, guys.
Favorite against Jamie Mullarkey, favorite against Alex Da Silva. The other fights, he was the underdog. And for Renato Moicano, with his takedowns, we saw it in Moicano's last time out. 4 days notice, flies from Brazil to the States, fights Dos Anjos, 5-round main event at 160 pounds, and gosh darn it.
He got lit up.
Didn't he win the first round? He got lit up, and there were points in the fight I thought it should have been stopped.
Yeah.
But my God, didn't he rally in that round? And the craziest part is, Moicano was coming off of a really, really nice win over Alexander Hernandez right before that.
He looked awesome.
He beats Hernandez in the striking with the grappling and so on and so forth. But Moicano wins that fight and doesn't go back to Florida. He goes home to Brazil for a bit and then just jumps off the couch and fights RDA. And so I don't look a whole lot into that fight. But for Moicano, what I do consider in this one is what he likes to do. He likes to feint the takedown and throw an uppercut. And I think that's a big thing in this fight. And it's not just an isolated incident. He does that in multiple occasions. He does like to throw the leg kick. He's a straight shot fighter, which could cause Riddell some issues. A guy that leads with his chin. But again, I agree with you. Moicano does struggle with the high tie stance, with a lot of those hooks, and this could be that fight.
I think this is a great fight, though. All over the place.
We have it on the fight of the night.
It is wild that neither one of these guys ranked for how skilled they are as mixed martial artists. That just shows you how good the 155-pound weight division is. Now, luckily, we have a bit more of a showcase fight further up on the card between Dustin Poirier and Michael Chandler. Two of the best, arguably, ever in the weight class, but I think this is another tremendous fight in the weight class. And for Riddell, I agree. I think there's a lot of ways he can have success. I just think this fight against Moicano is a big ass for a guy who was on a 2-fight losing streak.
You look at the odds in this one, they open at par. Moicano minus 125 as of now. Riddell, slight underdog, plus 105. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 60% Moicano.
I think they're going to be way over, honestly.
976 total votes, 51% Moicano, 38% by decision, 65% by submission for the 49% that are Brad Riddell, 67% by decision, 26% by knockout. So you thought they were going to be over.
I did, yeah.
You made a bit of a read on your pick. I think everybody knows what it is at this point. But I will say, Fight Night Picks fans are Brad Riddell fans. So I know there's going to be a lot of support for him down in the comments.
And again, I laid a game plan where he can win. Go to the body with the combinations early. Make it out to Moicano, raise his hands. To quote the great Sam Langford, if you kill the body, the head will die. I don't know why I know that quote because I couldn't sleep last night. So again, for Riddell, if he goes to the body, I think that can take a lot away from Moicano. But the problem is, again, Brad Riddell can have a lot of success in the first round with his striking, I think. I think that's fair. Moicano has really good cardio, though, and really good output to go along with that cardio. So I think this fight gets more difficult for Riddell every minute that passes. I think Moicano's the way better grappler. And the game plan that you had laid out for Jalen Turner leading into Brad Riddell's last fight, I think was very interesting. You said the problem with Brad Riddell is when he gets hurt, he shoots for takedowns, and I agree 100%. If he gets hurt and shoots for a takedown against Renato Moicano, this fight's over. We don't need to have this fight. Like, I should ask Brad Riddell that question before the fight and go, hey, if you get rocked, you're going to take down Renato Moicano with a lazy double leg? And if his answer is yes when I hand him that microphone, we don't need to have the fight because it's over by guillotine.
Remember Renato Moicano when he fought Demir Hadzevich? It was over so quick that Demir got up and he was like, what are we doing? I didn't think we were grappling. Where's the striking? So I like Moicano in the matchup. I know I've kind of shaded it that way as well. But again, the game plan's there for Riddell. Go to the body, make Moicano come up to the head or raise his guard as you throw the hooks, and then you can rip to the body. Moicano's shown a susceptibility there. I like Moicano with the leg kicks. I like the straight shots. I don't like the durability, but oddly enough, he had durability his last time out off the couch. So both of us going with Renato Moicano, the slight favorite in the matchup. Some great fights in this division on this card. Claudio Poyas is getting his due, and he's taking on Dan Hooker, Riddell's teammate. We also have Michael Chandler taking on Dustin Poirier. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Peru's Claudio Poyas is looking to prove that he's no meme stock, and he's finally getting his due. He's going to be taking on the Hangman, Dan Hooker, a guy who's no stranger to a barn burner, and he knows what he needs to do because for Hooker, he was on a heater. during the pandemic, Dan Hooker went off.
As
hard
as they get.
It started to go downhill. I mean, he took on Dustin Poirier. He took on Michael Chandler. He has a lost Islam Makhachev. He has a lost Arnold Allen. Last time I checked, those guys are pretty fucking good. Yeah. Like, Makhachev's the champ. Arnold Allen looks like the next great thing at 145 pounds. And if you look at it for Dan Hooker and his win sandwiched between two losses, he takes on Nasrat Haqparast in a fight that had a lot of extenuating circumstances. And Dan Hooker went, huh, I'm a wrestler now, not a striker. And he looked really, really good in that fight. Now, if Hooker does that against Claudio Poyas, his leg's going home to Killcliff FC in Southern Florida. But for Claudio Poyas, I feel like Fight Night Picks has been hip to this guy since he's made his return to the UFC. He beat Dahlism, Marcos Mariano, the Anderson Silva protege, who came into the UFC at 6-4 and left at 6-6. He looked amazing in that fight. He outstruck him pillar to post. It wasn't a close fight. It wasn't a fair matchup. But then he took years away, and he fought Jordan Leavitt. And in that fight, it was a battle of guys who don't strike very often but go for high crotch single legs. And Claudio won out in the wrestling exchanges. So his next time out, he takes on the boxer Chris Gritzmacher, wins that one. His last time out, he takes on the veteran, Clay Guida. Guida, I said this in the preview. Guida's best to box. He shouldn't go for takedowns. Guida goes for takedown. Gets out grappled, but it's not that he got out grappled.
It didn't Claudio even look real.
Went from a like full-on triangle to then armbar to then grabbing the leg, reaching under, and getting an e-bar in one of the slickest submission attempts I've ever seen. Poyas looked amazing. Matt, I think Poyas, again, like I said, he's finally getting his due. People know him. And this is on the main card of UFC 281. It's a battle for, is Dan Hooker still relevant? Is Claudio Poyas that next? Because Poyas was somewhere between 19 and 20 years of age when he appeared on the Ultimate Fighter Latin America Season 3. He got a win over Marcelo Rojo. He ended up in the finale. He ends up losing to Martin Bravo. But still, such a young prospect. Now he's finally made the move. Out of Peru, his father was his teacher. He was a Lucha Libre king. You scoffed at Lucha Libre at one point. I think you're a believer right
now. It's not like, okay, who's won a UFC title with Lucha Libre?
I mean, I've mentioned so many Lucha Libre things on this channel.
I know, and I'm just asking.
I mean, Marco Huas would have if he didn't get fights that were turned down.
Perfect.
But my point is, for Poyas, he's on that next Killcliff FC. You go to his Instagram right now. Obviously, Michael Chandler's on this card, but I'll be gosh darned if I wouldn't say that he's training primarily with Eddie friggin' Alvarez for this one.
This is a close fight, but it won't be by the time it's over, and that's a weird thing to say, because it's a difficult fight to tell you who's going to win, because Poyas has such a big advantage with his own offensive grappling and with his submission ability, of course, but Dan Hooker's way better on the feet, and it's not even close whatsoever.
So there's the numbers right there. And for Claudio Poyas, again, in his last three fights since the Jordan Leavitt fight, he rounded out his training camp going to then, what was it, Hard Knocks, Sanford, now it's Killcliff, but rounded it out there. Now he's made that his base and his home. We've seen the good body kick. We've seen the good leg kick. Poyas, we haven't seen much out of the boxing. Hopefully with Eddie Alvarez kind of figuring things out with his hands, but this might not be the matchup.
6 months is not enough. Hands. Exactly. Like, those advancements are good, and they will help him in the long run, but this is the fight that we want you to show off that, oh, you're a kickboxer now and you're Bangkok ready. The thing is, though, for Dan Hooker, he has gone for a lot of takedowns throughout his UFC tenure, and that's something that does get lost in the shuffle. Now, traditionally, it's after he kind of gets fatigued on the feet when he throws a lot of volume. The fight hasn't been finished one way or another, so he goes for a lot of offensive takedowns. I don't think we're going to see that in this matchup because Claudio is that dangerous off of his back and with his own attacks, but I just think Dan Hooker has such a big advantage with his striking. But I'm going to go back to what plagued Roy Jones Jr. the second half of his career when he wasn't good at all after 2003. Roy Jones Jr. went up to heavyweight against John Ruiz and won the heavyweight title, even though he was like a super middleweight, light heavyweight, middleweight. The weight change completely screwed him up, though, when he moved up in weight and then moved back down. He didn't lose weight the right way, and it just sort of took away that speed that he had. For Dan Hooker, I had a big issue with him moving down to 145 his last time out against Arnold Allen. I thought it was a bad move. I thought, hey, you moved up to 155 for a reason. Weight cutting normally doesn't get easier as you get older. Like, this is not a recipe for success. So I'll be very curious to see if Dan Dane Hooker will be the same Dane Hooker this time around. Now, I hope we do get that kind of hangman Dane Hooker, that one who is in a fight of the night every single time out there, because if that is the case, he's a difficult test for any young up-and-coming prospect, and that's what Claudio Poyas is at this stage of his career. I just worry that Dane Hooker has taken so much damage throughout his career that he is going to be a little bit worried about the striking of Claudio Poyas, even though I don't believe it's that big of a threat. I could see him just being a little bit overly cautious with some of the striking, and I think that's an area that could open up a takedown for Poyas.
Folks, you might think this is silly, but Dane Hooker, let's go back to a premier fight that went premierly wrong. The fight against Edson Barboza, and he struggled against the body attacks in that fight. If Claudio has anything, it's his leg kicks and it's his body kicks. They're snappy and there's a lot of power on both of them. But he won't get going with the hands, which is something that Dane Hooker, again, you saw the graphic, he excels in. Now for Poyas, training with Eddie Alvarez, as I mentioned, Gilbert Burns to get ready for this one. And Ian Escuza, a Peruvian Muay Thai artist who's very, very good. And if you do look at it, for Poyas, educated takedowns, high crotch single legs, and he has 3 knee bar wins in the UFC. The first one, he was getting beat pillar to post over Felipe Silva, or against Felipe Silva. His eyes swollen up, and he ends up getting that finish, and it's great. But again, if you do look at it for Dane Hooker, the volume's there, the power's there. If he can defend the takedown, stay on the outside, Hooker can get the win. It very much is a clash of styles. So you look at the odds. Hooker opened minus 200. He's a minus 165 right now, so the line has shifted towards Claudio Poyas. Poyas opened at a plus 170, plus 135 right now, so we have a look at the topology vote. Surprise to us, they are to you. And I'm going to say that experience favors Hooker with the fans. I'm going to say over under 70%.
I think it'll be over.
It's going to be over?
No.
1,021 total votes in Tapology. We don't know what's going on. 55% Poyas, 18% by decision, 72% by submission. For the 45% that have Hooker, 59% by decision, 32% by knockout. So the fans have Poyas to win. The odds are closing in slightly on Poyas. Eager to see where they are when we do question mark kicks on Saturday. But again, when you look at this one, Matt, I mean, Poyas growing into the martial artist, started on The Ultimate Fighter at 19, 20 years of age. Now he's 26. Poyas gets a slot in the main card, and a lot of people think he's going to win. However, the odds favor Hooker here.
Like what I said about some other fighters on losing streaks, at a certain point, it's time to stop. And with Dane Hooker, like you had mentioned, he's only lost to great fighters like Dustin Poirier, Michael Chandler, Islam Makhachev, current champion, and Arnold Allen, a guy who could fight for the title sooner rather than later at 145. I think all those fighters are significantly better than Claudio Poyas. I don't think that's a hot take by any means. Now, Claudio could become one of those fighters in the future. What I do think about Dane Hooker is he's kind of the gatekeeper between the very good and the great fighters in the division. I don't think Claudio Poyas is good enough to reach that level just yet. If we rematch this fight 2 years down the road, maybe he will reach that level, because you're right, he has shown the improvements, and that's a great thing to see from a guy who definitely is a specialist in one area. If you just keep on growing with the rest of your game, eventually you will get there. So for Poyas, I feel like I have been high on him throughout his UFC tenure, but I do like Dane Hooker in this matchup.
And it is a tough one with Hooker flip-flopping between the divisions. He's also still ranked. It's kind of an oddball one just considering the circumstances, but he has lost to very good fighters, and some of them quite quickly. I have Dane Hooker in the matchup due to the striking advantages, and that's what I think is going to win out here. For Poyas, he will walk you down, he will throw those thunderous kicks, and he doesn't really leave himself open to getting hit after he throws the kick. He doesn't have a big wind-up reset. He is very snappy with it, but when he walks guys down, he has a nice stance, but he doesn't throw anything up here, and he is susceptible to getting hit. So for those reasons, I like Dane Hooker. Would I be surprised if Poyas takes another leg and throws it up like the Christmas story, turns it into a lamp, so and has it at his house or apartment in Southern Florida? No. So let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Both of us going with Dane Hooker to get the win. It's a great fight. Another great one in this division on this main card. Poirier versus Chandler. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. The retirement fight for the answer, Frankie Edgar, who's 7 hours, 55 minutes, and 9 seconds of time combined in the UFC's octagon, is number one overall, adding to that coming up this weekend at Bantamweight, taking on El Guapo, Chris Gutierrez, whose 6-1-1 record inside of the UFC's octagon, has him primed and ready to make a push to try and enter the UFC's rankings. And of course, with somebody like Sean O'Malley at number one, there's a lot of people that are going to be hot and horny to end up in the top 15. And for Edgar, you look at it, and it's been a crazy run. I mean, he becomes UFC champion with a win at UFC, 112 over BJ Penn by decision, beats him again at UFC 118, ends up losing the belt against, of course, Benson Henderson. He had the wars against Gray Maynard, fight of the year contenders.
I thought he beat Bendo.
And yeah, well, the first fight or the second one?
The one where he gets hit by the upkick, I thought he lost. The other one, I thought he won.
Yeah, there's one that he has a little bit of an argument in. But for Edgar, it's been an interesting time after being the champion. He's had some good wins. He's had weird losses. He's 0-3 for title fights at 145 pounds. He's 0-2 against Jose Aldo in those. And he also lost to Max Holloway. And at bantamweight, it was a weird move. Now, he looks frame-wise like a guy who should have been bantamweight all along. 100%. It doesn't seem like the weight cut's taken too much out of him. And for Edgar, at 135 pounds, he still has the mobility. He still has the hand speed. He still has the volume. The durability's been a little weird, but I've liked what I've seen out of Frankie Edgar considering the circumstances. Now, his fight against Pedro Munhoz, he got chopped down by the leg kicks. I thought Munhoz won 3 rounds out of that fight. Edgar gets the win. The fight against Corey Sandhagen, he gets finished very quickly. The fight against Marlon Vera
looked good until he did.
My God, Frankie Edgar won the first round. In the second round, he looked pretty good.
Close.
And then Edgar, or, you know, he just gets hit by that meme front kick, and that's it.
And that's the thing you have to worry about with Frankie Edgar at this stage of his career. I remember going into the fight against Brian Ortega. That was the thing about Frankie. It was, hey, he's got a great chin. Yes, he gets dropped in a lot of his fights. He faces adversity. But when the going gets tough, he can kind of bite down on his mouthpiece and get tougher. But Brian Ortega finished him, and it was like, okay, not the greatest sign. He is getting up there. Hopefully, that's just sort of an outlier. Brian Ortega is getting a lot better with his striking. But we have seen Frankie Edgar's chin get checked a number of times at this stage of his career, and that's why he does find himself fighting a guy like Chris Gutierrez. But I do agree with you. It doesn't feel like Frankie Edgar gets a lot taken away from him with the weight cut down to 135, and I think the best evidence of that is the fact that he wanted his last fight in the UFC to be at 135. Like, there's a lot of fighters in the UFC who are in this sort of legacy stage of their career where they're in fun fights, they can offer difficult fights to top fighters, but you don't really look at them as a realistic option to be a title or champion sometime in the future. But Frank Edgar can still be a difficult fight for a lot of really good guys. Chris Gutierrez has the opportunity of a lifetime, though, and I think we're both going to agree on this. I'm very happy for Chris Gutierrez, and I really hope he does make the most of this opportunity, because a lot of the times it feels like the UFC wants to kind of pick their kind of golden boy, if you will, and they want to give them the favorable matchup against that aging star who's on their way out. Chris Gutierrez, to me, doesn't really feel like that guy. He just feels like a good fighter who's really been able to work on his skill set throughout his UFC, and he doesn't seem like the type of fighter who would get this kind of big opportunity, but I'm very happy he finds himself.
We talk about Gutierrez a lot on this channel because he's the leg kick king. I mean, his win over Vince Morales, TKO due to leg kicks. His fight against Andre Yule, he just batters him with leg kicks. And if you consider for Gutierrez, he has an interesting style because he can wrestle offensively and he has decent takedown defense. But if you look at it for Gutierrez, some matchups that he's had in the past against smaller guys that can throw a lot of volume, that can wrestle. Well, he lost to Timur Valiev in World Series of Fighting, same skill set. And he lost to Hany Barcelos, who will throw power with his hooks and go for power takedowns. Frank Edgar, power takedowns, we know this. So it is a little bit strange for Gutierrez, too. He does have an odd stance to him. He stands straight up, but low for the size of him. Like, he keeps his knees bent, and he will keep them a little bit low. Head up, and he keeps his hands about here. He doesn't have a high tie stance. He doesn't have a low boxing stance. They're just at about chest height, and they're out a little bit. So for Gutierrez, he can flow with the movement. He likes to try and counter off a lot of shots from his opponents, so he will bait you in. Doesn't really get too happy with his hands. Doesn't throw a lot of volume. And the craziest thing for him, against Bakary Dinaz last time out, he obviously looked amazing. You know how good he did, look and the finish that he was able to get. Did he win the first round against Bakary? I don't know. It was pretty darn close. But the point is, he goes for a spinning elbow, which he ends up getting in the second round, gets finished. Goes for a spinning elbow. And it's just like the Red Hot Chili Peppers. It was, give it away, give it away, give it away now. Because as he goes for it, Bakary goes and takes him up, slams him down. If he goes for that, again, he does end up getting the finish in the second round. So you can't take too much away from him. But There are a lot of things that I see in Gutierrez's game, and I'm sure the UFC saw them when they went to book this matchup, where it's like, okay, Frankie's going to be able to take him down here, here, and here, and grind out a win.
This is the only part where I disagree, and I'm going to call myself out, because I've said this a lot throughout this card. You have fighters on these sort of longer losing streaks, and now they're finally getting that step down in competition for fighting the more elite fighters in the weight class. I would say this fight's kind of similar to some of those other ones. The difference is, Dan Hooker's not 41 years old. Andre Petrosky's not 41 years old. I guess that's not a good example. But, like, Frankie Edgar at this stage of his career does get hurt when he gets hit by clean shots. And I know he was able to last really late with Marlon Vera. Marlon Vera didn't land a single clean shot until he did knock him out in the third round.
Yeah, like, Vera in the first round was just kind of hanging out. The second round, Vera looked pretty good. I scored the second round for Vera. I scored the first round for Edgar. And I picked Edgar in that fight. So, teehee all you want. It's fun to laugh at the end of it. But when Vera finally turned it on in the third round, Edgar couldn't handle the pressure.
No, and that's my thing with Edgar. I think he can have a lot of success in this fight, but I think once Gutierrez does start to land his power shots, I think Edgar's going to struggle with them. And I know we pointed to the fact that Gutierrez has struggled defensively with the takedown. That's true. Frankie Edgar's never checked a leg kick in his whole life, and he's been fighting MMA for 20 years now. And I know Jose Aldo's the big example of a guy who leg kicked the heck out of him, but still.
So did Pedro Munhoz.
So did Pedro Munhoz, and other guys have been able to replicate that game plan. Marlon Vera has success with the leg kick. Now, that wasn't a five-round fight, so you weren't necessarily able to tell the damage as the fight was able to go on, but still, the fact that Edgar slowed down a little bit in the third round and then got finished might point to the fact that the leg kicks troubled him. So I do think that this is an obvious fight where both guys have very obvious ways where they can have a lot of success. I just don't know what Frankie Edgar's level of durability is at this stage of his career. I think he can go out there and have a really veteran performance where it's one of those y'all must have forgot and hey, I was a champion for a reason, remember when I beat Gray Maynard? But I also see a world where you have a 41-year-old bantamweight who's been in a lot of really tough fights, who's been finished in two straight fights, fighting a guy who can go out there and get a finish.
My trouble with having a lot of confidence in this one is Gutierrez is one of those guys, like, he doesn't turn it on from minute one to minute two or three. Like, it takes him a little bit. He cuts really good angles. He picks his shots. He can get a little bit lackadaisical, and that's where Frankie Edgar, the movement hasn't slowed, the footwork hasn't slowed, the volume hasn't slowed, and the takedowns are still there. So you look at the odds in this one, Gutierrez open to minus 130, minus 217, Edgar open plus 110, plus 176. We have a look at the fan vote over on Tapology. Now this is where I zig. I doubt it's very close. I'm going to say over under 80% Chris Gutierrez.
I think it'll be under.
It's going to be under, slightly under. 915 total votes, 75% Gutierrez, 30% by decision, 64% by knockout for the 25% that have Edgar, 88% by decision. So Matt, this is a tough one. Again, I thought Edgar was going to be able to beat Vera. He won the first round. In the third round, he looked good until he got pressured and he got finished. I don't know if Chris Gutierrez is going to be able to finish Frankie Edgar, but I do have a hard time trying to make a pick on this. And I say that as the odds get further apart.
I like the kicks from El Guapo. Now, I don't love where the odds are. If they were where they opened, I would like Chris Gutierrez a lot more. But
yeah.
Again, I am still going to pick him in this fight. And I kind of gave it away with the point that I brought up with not the fact that Frank Edgar can't still look good against good fighters. Again, we saw that his last time out against Marlon Vera. The problem was, Vera didn't do anything in the first round. Like, you can win a round when your opponent's just waiting and trying to get your timing. And I think for Edgar, if he does find himself against an opponent who starts to throw a little bit more like Gutierrez, I agree with you. Gutierrez isn't a guy who's going to go out to really wow you with his volume. He's not like a, think of like a prime Max Holloway, especially against Calvin Kattar, where it's just from jump street. I think it will take him a little bit of time to ease into this fight, but I think if he can defend some of those initial takedowns, Frankie Edgar at this stage of his career isn't getting a lot of offensive takedowns. He likes to rush in, throw that like jab, straight jab combination, kind of duck in for the takedown. If he doesn't get it, he does seem comfortable to kind of turn away, angle away, and then reset back in. I think if he is dedicated to the wrestling, he would have a lot more success, but I don't know if at 41 years old he's really going to be able to go in there and chain wrestle like we saw the classic Frankie Edgar. And that's why I know I'm kind of contradicting myself from earlier on in the card, where it's okay, at a certain point you've lost to great fighters, this isn't one of those other guys, but I do like Gutierrez in this fight, mainly because of Edgar's age.
I do like Gutierrez in this matchup, but again, I hate the odds. Pop and popcorn here. I have to make a pick because it's the channel, but the underdog Frankie Edgar is a little bit, I don't know, scintillating, I guess is the word that I'm going to go with, but both of us going with Boss Root and El Guapo. Chris Gutierrez to get the win in the matchup. Let us know down below who you have. Is it the legend? Is it the 31-year-old up-and-comer? I don't know. Matt, we have a big-time card coming up. Poirier's fight and Chandler, two title fights that you're not going to want to miss. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
coming up this weekend, a possible fight of the year contender. Both of these guys have those accolades on their resume. We have the former interim lightweight champ, Dustin Poirier, taking on the three-time Bellator lightweight champ, Michael Chandler. And we said this from the open. I mean, for Michael Chandler, a fight of the year 10 years apart, one against Justin Gaethje, unsuccessful in that matchup, but he did get the win over Eddie Alvarez years ago. And for Alvarez, that fight, 2011 was that matchup against Alvarez.
Is it fair to say Michael Chandler is at the hardest level of competition since entering the UFC as any fighter we've ever seen?
Yeah, it's absolutely wild if you look at it right there. I mean, for Chandler, he debuts against Dan Hooker, knocks him out promptly, gets a title shot against Charles Oliveira. Looks like he's on his way in the first round to getting the win. Gets finished in the second round. Takes on Justin Gaethje. And his last time out beats the aging legend Tony Ferguson.
Some of the better fighters we have ever seen at 155 pounds. That's the thing for Michael Chandler. You know what, Craig? High five. We should give ourselves a bit of a pat on the back. Because a lot of people were after us after we said he was going to lose to Charles Oliveira after his second fight in the UFC. They said, oh, there's no way you guys would have thought he was going to get knocked out. But listen, to our credit, we were big Michael Chandler fans when he was over in Bellator. Like, I watched every Michael Chandler fight he had in Bellator, basically post-Eddie Alvarez on when I really liked MMA. So I do feel like I do have a decent read on Chandler, and this is the read I can give you. He has thunderous power in his hands. His nickname is Iron for a reason. Iron Mike Tyson is normally who you think of.
He's one of the more athletic fighters you're going to find in MMA.
Kid's built like a brick shithouse. Now, at 36 years of age, though, you don't have to worry about how many miles are still left in the odometer, because he's been in so many crazy fights now that at a certain point it does take a bit away from you, and that's always been the thing about Michael Chandler, and we have talked about this at length throughout his UFC tenure. If he hits you first, he's gonna win. If you hit him first, though, that's when it does get interesting, because for Chandler, he is a really well-rounded fighter. I haven't even talked about his offensive wrestling, his submission ability, and those are very high level too, but for the most part, when you think about Chandler, I guess you do think about his wrestling, but you think about his thunderous punching power and, like you said, his overall physicality. I just worry about how he's going to be able to eat shots from a guy like Dustin Poirier, because you can go back and look at some of Michael Chandler's fights he had in Bellator. Think about a guy like Goichi Yamauchi, who I know had to move up in weight, and we can get into that. That's a whole conversation for another time, but Goitia's not on Dustin Poirier's level. Like, Dustin Poirier is one of the greatest lightweights of all time. He's been in Fight of the Nights with some of the other greatest lightweights of all time. He was able to hurt Michael Chandler with a hook kick. Tony Ferguson was able to hurt him with a jab in the opening round of their fight. And again, to Chandler's credit, he did win both of those fights, but you can't just look at the result and forget about how you ended up going to that result.
And a lot of people pointed to it before Chandler came into the UFC. It was, well, he just got knocked out, what, a year, little over a year ago. Over Patricio Pitbull in the Revenge Tour fight, because Chandler knocked out Patricky, Patricio looking to become double champ. Patricio gets the win. And if you consider it after that, win over Sydney Outlaw, win over Benson Henderson, but what do they really mean in the grand scheme of things? For Chandler, proved the doubters wrong, 2-2 in the UFC, 2009 NCAA Division I All-American at Missouri. And if you look at it for Dustin Poirier, Matt talking about Michael Chandler and the road miles, Dustin Poirier has been rode hard and put up wet, I would say.
The difference is, though, he doesn't get dropped by the majority of clean shots that he eats. Like, Poirier has eaten some big shots in his UFC career, and I always rolled my eyes at this because I thought it was ridiculous. Like, when our channel really blew up, it was when Poirier fought Conor McGregor the second time and the third time. People were down for those videos, Craig, I remember it. And I would tell anybody who listened, hey, Dustin Poirier is going to win this fight, because everybody said, oh, well, he's not durable. That's what Conor McGregor said. He's got no chin. That might have been the case down at 145 pounds, but I think we all know that big weight cuts come with bad chins. At 155 pounds, Dustin Poirier has been in a number of Fight of the Nights, and you're right. At a certain point, the hourglass is going to run out, but at least up until this point, I would say at this weight class, he's proven to be the more durable guy out of these two, but I think this is one of the more heavyweight, non-heavyweight fights we've ever seen in the UFC.
No, there's way more technique involved, but what I will say to Dustin Poirier, bumping the hot sauce, I think he's got four different kinds of his own now. I've tried it before. I don't know if he's ever had De Bomb Beyond Insanity. I don't know if he's ever had Steve-O's Butthole Destroyer. Because, I mean, if you look at it for Poirier, you consider the hotness of some of those hot sauces. He's got the KO one. Nothing beats
his are good, though. They're tasty.
Yeah, the Steve-O one actually is really tasty. The Butthole Destroyer, and then he's got the Steve Haas's hot sauce for your butthole. That one's just, you can use that for daily use.
I was talking about Poirier sauce.
It's very good. But when you do focus in on this matchup, Matt, I think there's a couple of differentiating factors. I mean, for Poirier, 22-6 with a no contest in the UFC. Yes, he's fought Eddie Alvarez. One's a no contest, one's a knockout win. what was it, two fights after the no contest, he ends up fighting Alvarez, beating him again. He has a fight against Khabib that he loses. He beat Justin Gaethje. Chandler lost to Justin Gaethje. MMA math, we'll play it where it is. But what I do look at for Chandler is he loves that full extension, feet planted, overhand right to land. If Poirier does a skip to my Louis, right hand dominant as a southpaw, he can land the check right hook on that.
And that's the thing too, if you go back and watch the Poirier-Gaethje fight, I know that was a tough fight, it was a 5-round fight, and Gaethje in round 3 before Poirier knocks him out in the 4th, hurts Poirier with a good shot over the top. Poirier has wicked boxing defense in that fight though. Like, there's a point in that fight where Gaethje throws like 3 haymakers, Poirier reads them all perfectly and just knows the third one's coming, moves his head out of the way with his hands down, and like blows a kiss at the punch as it's going by. When Poirier isn't in his brawl mode where he squares up to his opponent, he does have good boxing defense, especially on the back foot. And I do worry about Chandler's size in this division. I know it's not something we talk about a lot, but Michael Chandler's not a big lightweight by any means, and I know Poirier is a former featherweight, so you don't necessarily think about him as a big guy in this weight division, but I'll be curious to see these guys when they do square off, because Poirier is a big guy, especially against a lot of these fighters. He was much thicker than Charles Oliveira when he fought against him. I know Max Holloway was moving up in weight, but the size against Holloway was a big conversation too, so I'll be curious to see how these guys match up physically, because I do think Chandler has a big wrestling advantage on his side. I'll just be curious to see if he really wants to go for it though, because there is a part of Chandler that likes the fight of the nights and that will get into the brawl, and if he does get into that type of a fight, that's probably going to lead to his detriment, because I think if Michael Chandler wants to have a lot of success, it's going to have to mix in the takedowns with his overhands and make this an MMA fight, because I know Poirier is good at threatening with submissions off his back, but I still think Michael Chandler's the better grappler for grappling's sake if it hits the mat.
I think size-wise, Chandler's going to have a lot of advantages in this matchup, but if you look at it for Poirier, I mean, I mentioned the record in the UFC, joined after a WEC stint in 2011, beat title hopeful Josh Grispy in the debut. And then, Grispy didn't get that fight with Jose Aldo. But if you focus in for Dustin Poirier, you look at all the good, you look at some of the bad. He's training over at American Top Team with Johnny Ubland for this fight, Bellator middleweight champ, as well as Mateusz Gamrot to get ready for the wrestling of Chandler.
A pretty good wrestler, yeah.
The flip for Chandler's MMA wrestling, I have two fights for you that if you want to go back and watch them to get ready for a fight with Poirier, you might go, well, geez, he's going to have success. The second fight against Brent Primus is the one where, hey, the first one, was it a fluke? Chandler was a giant favorite against Primus in the first fight. He has that weird Liz Frank, is it a knee, is it a foot thing?
That weird nerve thing, yeah.
But in the fight, the second fight against Brent Primus, other than Primus having early success and getting the back, it's all Chandler, all ground and pound for 4 rounds of that fight. The fight that he has against, Matt, Brandon Gertz, where he picks him up and he slams him and he dislocates his shoulder as he does it and he gets the win. Now, Chandler's a big favorite against Brandon Gertz in that fight. But those are just the skills that he possesses. And that's kind of like the cupcake under the icing. The icing's great. You see the knockouts. You see the striking. The body of the game is the wrestling, and if he brings it into a fight against Poirier where he has a decided advantage in the wrestling, you win that fight, Islam Makhachev's next, unless Alexander Volkanovski gets the party.
I guess my question really is, I'm not trying to play MMA math, but Chandler wasn't able to go out there and really dominate Justin Gaethje with his wrestling, and I know Gaethje has the wrestling background, but it's not like Justin Gaethje's some lights-out defensive grappler. And I know Gaethje, let's say Gaethje has better takedown defense than Dustin Poirier. I'll give you that. I don't think he's as good of a defensive grappler as Poirier, though. So I will be curious just to see what this fight looks like once it does hit the mat. Because I agree with you. I think Chandler is the better fighter if he gets on top. And that's a position where he'll have a lot of success. But I don't think Poirier is some net zero off his back. I think he will be able to threaten enough to at least get this fight back up to the feet. And on the feet, this is a very interesting one. Because both guys possess enough power to knock each other out. I don't think you need me to tell you that if you've ever watched either one of them. So this fight is just so good on so many levels. I'm curious. Neither guy's been able to fight Islam yet. These are two of the few who haven't been able to. Do you think the winner of this does get that next title shot? Or does the winner of this probably have to fight Benil to really cement who's next?
They get a money belt fight because Islam Makhachev pay-per-views are going to need to have a bigger main event. But when we do look at the odds for this one,
so no.
You focus in on it for Poirier. Open minus 200, minus 205 right now. Chandler open plus 170, plus 175 or thereabouts right now. We have a look over at Fight Night Picks. We threw it out there to you in the community tab. We'll update the votes on this one to see what you're thinking. And so far, Matt, it's not that close. You know, we're talking 69% for Dustin Poirier, 31% for Michael Chandler. Your comments down below. Al is saying Chandler will find a way, but it's not going to be easy. Bill saying, I think Chandler can win if he mixes in the takedowns. Poirier striking so much more precise. He's going to get lit up if he tries to stand with him the whole fight. Chad's torn. Going to go with the more active fighter, Chandler by decision. And the Wretch saying Dustin by TKO. Chandler's chin won't hold up. So, Matt, the odds are with Poirier. The votes are with Poirier. I mentioned it. Overhand extension, Chandler right hand, check right hook, Poirier. But the check right hook's there most of the night. The boxing combinations favor Poirier. He's got the speed. He's got the power. Chandler has the wrestling, the overhand right, and a good leg kick to go with it. Who do you have in the pick?
Iron isn't the only thing that Michael Chandler has in common with Mike Tyson. It's not just the nickname. He does duck a lot when he throws his punches, and that's the problem. Justin Gaethje was able to catch him with a really clean uppercut when they were fighting. What's one of Dustin Poirier's best punches? He's got that left uppercut that he likes to follow up with the right hook. It's a really basic boxing combination, but it is one that I can see having a lot of success against Michael Chandler. I admit that Chandler could go out there and have a ton of success with his wrestling. I still think he's going to go out there with the wrestling shoes for 15 pure minutes. And I do think in the striking exchanges, it's going to be dangerous enough for Michael Chandler to where I'm going to predict Dustin Poirier. And the wild thing, too, is Poirier's been around for a while, and I could see the first person to ever give him back-to-back losses being Charles Oliveira and Michael Chandler, two pretty darn good fighters, but that's just a wild stat about Dustin Poirier that hasn't really got noticed. Like, the fact that he has had such a crazy strength of schedule throughout his UFC tenure without suffering back-to-back losses is really impressive, but again, if anyone would do it, it's probably Oliveira and Michael
Chandler. And it's definitely a big factor when you do look at the countdown. It's like the first scene there is, Chandler, could he be the one to earn Dustin Poirier a second consecutive loss? I look at this one and you look at the fight against Charles Oliveira. For Michael Chandler, great first round, second round gets finished. Dustin Poirier, great first round, second round he gets ground out for a lot of control, third round he gets submitted. So for Poirier, that's a tough way to go out. For Chandler, there's definitely avenues there. I do like the boxing out of Poirier. I ever so slightly edge Poirier. I love the odds on Michael Chandler. So maybe there's going to be a play there. Maybe that's a commentary for question mark kicks. The sidekick for this card, 2 hours. The question mark kicks, 2 hours before the prelims. The sidekick during the main card. You can hang out with us. We're going to be watching this fight. A possible fight of the year contender at lightweight. Both of us with Poirier in the matchup. Two title fights up at the top. Carlos Sparza taking on Zhang Wei Li in the main event, the trilogy. Alex Pereira challenging Israel Adesanya. It's going to be great. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time title fight coming up this weekend in the co-main event of UFC 281. We have the strawweight title up for grabs. It was from 2014 to 2022. That's what it was. Wow. For Carlos Sparza to win the belt, lose the belt, and then win that belt back again. She gets that win over Rose Namajunas. Are they making documentaries about Carlos Sparza? No, they're not. But of her opponent that she beat, yes, they are. She's going to be taking on Magnum Zhang Wei Li. And listen, for Zhang Wei Li, former UFC champion, the run was fun. The losses of late weren't all that great, but she picked up a giant winner last time out, and she put a stamp on the second fight against Joanna Jędrzejczyk. Pretty well, retired her, gets a win by finish. The losses before that, Rose Namajunas, the second one, was it a mistake? It was a close fight, with Namajunas getting the win by split decision. But coming into this fight, I think a big overarching conversation will be around the odds for this one. Zhang Wei Li open to minus 150, minus 366. Esparza open plus 130, plus 280 at this point. We've had two champions come in this year looking to defend and coming in as big underdogs. You look at it, Glover Teixeira against Yuri Prochazka, Charles Oliveira against Islam Makhachev, and both times, the challenger was able to get the win in the matchup. For Carlos Sparza, we know how good her wrestling is. For Zhang Wei Li, I think a big portion of the conversation should be around the camp changes. Training at one point, Fight Ready MMA. For this one, getting ready at Bangtan Muay Thai. Brad Riddell also getting ready there. The Hickman brothers doing great work. Loma Lookman Me, look at that. The prodigy out of that gym. She's looked amazing since she's gone there. But Bang Tao and the Hickman brothers really making a name for themselves, and obviously a great catch with Zhang Wei Li turning that camp into her home. You look at the matchup here, Matt, though, and obviously we see the posts on Reddit, on Twitter, Zhang Wei Li's picking up Francis Ngannou with the PI.
I couldn't do that.
That's kind of impressive. Now, a static lift like that's a little bit different than a 25-minute MMA fight against Carla Esparza. But Matt, when we focus in on this matchup, this is going to sound silly, but Zhang Wei Li justified where the odds have ballooned from minus 150 to minus 366?
100%. I think so, honestly, because here's the thing with Zhang Wei Li. She's kind of the midway point between a fighter like Ioana and a fighter like Jessica Andrade. Now, I would say she's closer to Ioana, but hear me out. She has the power in her shots, but she's also an extremely technical fighter. Who gives her trouble? Well, people who are also very technical fighters, because they can match her with a lot of what they do on the feet, and if they're elusive enough, they can avoid some of her bigger power shots and at least get their volume numbers high enough to really match her. I know Rose was able to knock her out with a head kick, but still, a lot of that was the technique behind it and less just the pure power. It was, hey, she was able to outthink Wei Li, if anything, and then land that head kick. So, but my big point is, Wei Li really struggles with technique more than just physical strength. Look at the fight she had against Jessica Andrade, one of the strongest pound-for-pound fighters I think we've ever seen in the UFC. Jessica went across the cage, tried to bully her, tried to get really rough with her, get her in that clinch, pick her up, and do what she always does, slam chicks on their head, knock them out, or choke them unconscious. Wei Li got her in the clinch, was really technical, and was kind of able to play the matador to Jessica Andrade's bull. So now we look at Carla Esparza. Is she a technical striker on the feet?
She's efficient.
Exactly. To her credit, she has grown in her striking repertoire throughout her UFC tenure, but it's not like she's throwing 720 spin kicks like Yair Rodriguez. It is a lot of basic boxing combinations. Now, to her credit, it is weird. Sometimes they can work out. If she is throwing a lot of punches, her opponents do have to respect the shots coming back their way, so it doesn't really allow them to just tee off with their own, and it really makes them be concerned about the takedown attempt too. And I think that's one area that Carla can have success. Just threatening with the takedown, really making Wei Li worried about that part of her game. But what I worry about is when Carla wasn't having success with her wrestling against Ioana in the first fight, she just bam takedown attempts from across the cage. It was really defensive with them, almost like trying to hide her head with some of the takedown attempts. I think Wei Li is a very high level striker and a technical enough striker to damage Carla if she does go into some of those desperation takedown attempts. And I think those are just going to make Wei Li's job that much easier. And you hate to say this when there's a sitting champion fighting a challenger, because hey, you're the UFC champion for a reason. You went through a lot to get there. I just don't know what Carla's one path is going to be to get a win. Yes, her wrestling is very good, but it's not like she's the best wrestler we've ever seen in the division. Like, I've seen Carla struggle with her grappling in some cases. So I just don't know what Carla's going to be able to do for 16 minutes of this fight, I guess, just to be able to win a judge's decision.
26 or whatever your analogy is. I mean, just for this to be a five-round fight, you look at it for Esparza and her last time out against Rose Namajunas, it was, we're incredibly tentative on the feet, the two of us. Esparza gets some takedowns and some control time. She's able to get the win. Now, Esparza, traditionally, you look at it, the takedown accuracy, 35%. Zhang Wei Li, 60% takedown defense. And that could be cause for concern. The striking numbers, Zhang Wei Li, and this is because of the fights with Yanni and Jacek, but 5.78 strikes landed per minute to Carla Esparza's 2.2 strikes landed per minute. Esparza has gotten better with her striking as her UFC tenure's gone on. She's aligned herself with Team Oyama and stuck with it, and you've really seen a great bond between the coach and the athlete. And for Zhang Wei Li, mixing things up, cross-training, champ camp with Deiveson Figueiredo and Cejudo for a while, and she did look really good in the second fight against Ioana Jędrzejczyk in retiring her. But again, the strength advantage, the striking, a glaring striking advantage. It really is a tough fight to give you a non-biased prediction.
I think Wei Li could take down Carla, honestly,
in this one. So you look at the odds, they are what they are. We have a look at the fan vote over on Tapology. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 85% Zhang Wei Li.
I think they're going to be over.
Oh, my Lord. 1,123 total votes, 93% Zhang Wei Li, 80% by knockout. For the 7% that have Esparza, 73% by decision. If Carla Esparza wins this fight, as the champion, it would almost be more surprising than when Juliana Pena beat Amanda Nunes the first time.
I wouldn't say
that. That might be a little bit of a stretch, yeah, but again, a champion as this big of an underdog, and 93% of the fans have the challenger to win, that doesn't happen every every day.
And the majority of the time, even when you do have a champion who's an underdog, it's because there's a challenger who is so hyped up. They're like an undefeated prospect like we've never seen before. Remember when Francis was the favorite when he fought Stipe the first time? I know it didn't work out for him that time around, but still, you have these really uber prospects. We know about Wei Li. It's not like she's just burst onto the scene. Like, she's been around for a while now. I just think her skill set and what she's been able to show in the cage is much more well-rounded than Carla. Now, again, Carla does have that one area of her game that has been quite dominant up until this point. She is on a big win streak. She is the champ for a reason. I just think stylistically, this is as difficult of a matchup as anybody in the top 15 for Carla.
Both of us going with Bang Tao Muay Thai to kick off a big time opportunity because they're going to get their first champion. So we assume in Zhang Wei Li to get the win coming up this weekend. Matt, we have Israel Adesanya, Alex Pereira, the trilogy fight. We're going to be talking about it live on the channel during the sidekick. So hang out with us throughout the week. It's a great week to be an MMA fan. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, the main event of UFC 281, we have the last stylebender, Israel Adesanya, looking to right the wrongs, getting the win in the trilogy. He's taking on Teixeira MMA and Fitness's own Alex Pereira, the former glory middleweight and light heavyweight champ. That wasn't good enough. It was simultaneous. This pretty guy impressive. Is a legend in kickboxing. The record 33-7 with 21 knockouts. For Adesanya in kickboxing, 75-5, but two of those losses to Alex Pereira. We're going to have a lot to say about those two fights that they had in kickboxing because I'm sure there's a lot of people that are going to talk about the fact that this is in MMA. It's going to be in a big cage at MSG. Who's going to shoot for the first takedown? This is mixed martial arts. I really doubt we're going to see a lot in terms of the grappling from either of these two men. But when you focus in on this matchup, Matt, for Israel Adesanya to go from fighting Rob Wilkinson to where he is right now, and the run he's been able to go on, undefeated at middleweight, the lone loss to Jan Blachowicz, it's really been interesting to see this progression evolution for Adesanya inside of the UFC's octagon.
And I would say he's one of the most effective stars they've been able to build in the UFC up until this point because they built him the right way. His first fight, like you said, against Wilkinson, then against Marvin Vettori, then against Derek Brunson. It was before people knew who Marvin Vettori was. That's a difficult fight in hindsight. But then he fought Brad Tavares, I guess, before Derek Brunson. But there was an obvious progression in his level of opposition all the way up until the title. Now, I know he fought Anderson Silva like after the Derek Brunson fight, and that was weird. He kind of looked kind of human in that fight, but it was weird. That fight, I don't think you can look too much into it because Adesanya was fighting like a childhood hero of his. And oddly enough, like I had mentioned in the previous fight, when technique really matters, and especially at this level, it does. Anderson Silva, if nothing else, even at this age, is still very technical with his striking. So that's why he's able to make it somewhat competitive with Adesanya. But I'll be very curious to see just what does Adesanya have to do in this fight to really win people over? And I know that's a weird thing to say, but it feels like at this point in people's careers, people are waiting for more out of Israel because he had the knockouts early on. He was damaging guys really early on in his fighting, but now he has reached sort of that point fighting phase of his career. And I know as two fellow Canadians, we love George St. Pierre more than anybody else. Hashtag still my goat. But GSP reached a certain point in his career where he started to fight in a bit of a safer manner. And there's no problem with that. You're going to hold your belt for a lot longer, but you do tend to fight outside of character. And for Adesanya, I'm curious if he is going to kind of go back in the more aggressive version of himself because he does have history with this guy. This isn't some guy who he has no respect for his striking, who he knows, hey, I'm a former glory kickboxer. This is just some MMA fighter. There's no way he can strike with me. Alex Pereira has beaten Israel Adesanya in the past, and he's one of the few fighters who, if you just look at what his pure kickboxing credentials are, he has probably a higher level background than even a guy like Israel Adesanya. So I think the storylines going into this fight are really interesting. But the problem is, it does feel like Pereira has been built up just to fight Adesanya, and that's what this whole build-up's been. So let's say he wins. Let's say he goes out there, hits him with a left hook like he did against Sean Strickland. I still think sort of the post-fight's going to be a little bit weird. They could do an immediate rematch. Don't get me wrong. I'm sure they're going to. Adesanya's been a very long time champion at 185. I just don't really know what they do. I think Pereira to me reminds me a lot of Cody Garbrandt, where Cody Garbrandt felt like he was built up by Team Alpha Male to beat Dominic Cruz. And then he beat Dominic Cruz. And then it kind of went off the fairway, if you will, and didn't look all that great for Pereira. I hope they weren't just building him to beat Adesanya, and this is kind of it for him.
That was kind of the plan. I mean, he beats Andreas Mihailidis, struggles with the takedowns in the first round, second round starches him. He then takes on Bruno Silva, the former M1 Global champ. It's an absolutely amazing fight. Go back and watch that one. Pereira comes out in the winning end, and he didn't do too bad in the grappling stages.
I would say his cardio looked good, too. It held up.
And his cardio did look good for a guy who 34, 35 years of age. Mixed martial arts isn't your art, it's kickboxing. And we know for Pereira, very early on in his career, let's do this MMA thing, get submitted. But you look at his last fight against Sean Strickland, you would have thought, hey, Shawnee, you're training Extreme Couture, Eric Nixick likes you. Put the wrestling shoes on.
He did,
walks
though.
Across and gets knocked out. So now we have to talk about the kickboxing fights. Because if you look at it in 2016, you have a decision win for Alex Pereira. Go over to Wikipedia, they say it's a 5-round decision. Go anywhere else on the internet, watch the fight, it's 3 rounds. And in that fight, Matt, in 2016, it's in China. And Israel Adesanya does the most pro-China promo I've ever seen ripped. He walks out as the Black Dragon, is his nickname, and he goes out there and he fights Alex Pereira. And watching the first round, it was very, very close. And watching the second round, it was very, very close. I thought Adesanya did enough in the first 3/4 of the round to win it, but in the last quarter of that round, Alex decided, you know what, flipping the switch, I'm throwing all the hooks I have, and he really did pour it on. And then in the third round, I thought Adesanya won, so you could have made a case that either guy won that fight. All three judges scored it 29-28 for Pereira to get the win in that one. And I thought in that fight, Matt, in my notes I had Adesanya fighting in those kickboxing fights to win. He's not fighting not to lose.
It's surprising how good pure kickboxers are at striking compared to like average UFC fighters. I know that doesn't, like, that might sound like I'm discrediting the vast majority of MMA fighters. But these guys have forgot more about striking than most people on this card know about striking. And I can't stress that enough. Like, that's how high level both these guys are. I don't care who wins by knockout if someone does stop the other one. I'm not going to completely discredit the other ones because these are two of the best pure strikers on planet Earth, regardless of sports.
But if you do, you go, you look at that first fight, you watch the things that Pereira did to have success, round two, round one. Cutting off the squared circle, he was cutting off the ring in kickboxing, and as soon as he could get Adesanya out of that kicking range, that's when he was able to land those short leg kicks, and he's got so much zip. His hips are made of different things, I think, and if you look at it, the way that he floats it out there and pulls it back, and then he throws those hooks to close distance, when he's able to do that against Adesanya, he had tons of success. Fight one, fight two. The next fight takes place in 2017. It's in Brazil, and it's a round three knockout for Alex Pereira. But if you watch that fight, Adesanya again, fighting to win, not fighting not to lose. Round one, I had it for Adesanya. Round two, I mean, Adesanya was on point. He's landing every single right hand for Adesanya was landing on Pereira. And the other thing that I noticed out of Pereira fighting in kickboxing to Pereira fighting in MMA, Pereira shells up. And he likes to use his gloves to block a lot of the punches, which you see in the kickboxing fights. You see it a little bit in MMA. He still kind of defends this way. So if you have a fighter that throws a lot of hooks, Pereira does. But as an opponent, if you see an opponent doing that, they could have a lot of success against Pereira. But for Adesanya, right hands through the guard, right hands on the outside. The kicks are on point. He gets a standing eight count at one point in the second round. He's pouring it on.
Bad.
And after the standing eight count, Pereira has to clinch every time to wait for the referee to separate them.
And then he knocks him out maybe 15 seconds
and then
after that.
Third round starts. Pereira lands a left hook, starches Adesanya, and the fight's over.
And that's what I keep on going back to. Okay, let's say you think both these guys are similar level strikers. And of course they are. Let's just give them both a 10 out of 10, if you will. Adesanya has had a lot more time to refine his kickboxing into an MMA skill set. Whereas for Pereira, even if you think he started out from a better foundation in kickboxing, maybe you think he is the better kickboxer. I just don't know if he's had enough time to completely refine it. And I know he
might. What does that have to do in this fight, though?
This is what I'm going to say. I know we disagree on this and you don't think there's going to be a takedown attempt, and there might not be, but if there is, Adesanya in his MMA career has at least shown a few glimpses where his defensive grappling isn't terrible. I go back to what he was able to show against Kelvin Gastelum. He threatens with a triangle off of his back, which is able to then get the sweep, which is able to get him back up to his feet, and that's how he wins the fifth round. Again, I don't know if there is going to be a takedown between either one of these guys in this fight, and honestly, whoever goes for the takedown is probably only doing it because things on the feet aren't going well for them, but what I do think is, if either other guy is going to have any success on the ground story, it's probably going to be Adesanya, just because we've at least shown some of those glimpses in his MMA game up until this point.
Adesanya, through his UFC tenure, has not earned a single takedown, and for Alex Pereira, we'll see if Glover Teixeira is able to add maybe a little bit of a wrinkle into his back pocket, and he could ghost for some. But yeah, you look at this matchup again. You have to think, the doubt, it creeps into the head of Israel Adesanya. That's going to be a lot of the conversation. And for Alex Pereira, a hand-picked opponent. Now, he was put into an advantageous position to get this fight. He obviously has the wins over in kickboxing. The first one, it was Shinsi. The second one, he was losing, but the third round starts, and he comes out swinging, and he lands that knockout blow. And it's not a, hey, we're going to count this one out. It's over. It's over, to the point where Pereira's running around the ring and taunting him. And
they gave Adesanya, like, oxygen.
Yeah, he's in his corner, and he's yelling at him. Like, it was a win. So there was no doubt left in that fight. We have a look at your votes. We threw this one out there to you in the community tab. Wow. Almost 1,000 votes, 51% with the champion, who's 23-1 in MMA, the 6-1 man, Pereira, getting 49% of your votes. We're going to have a look at the comments section. Luke is saying, I think Izzy wins comfortably from distance, unanimous decision. Hanky says, Alex loses every moment till he catches Izzy in the fourth round with an overhand right. Joe says, Izzy by stoppage inside three rounds. Different sports, different rule sets. There won't be a standing eight count to save Alex this time. And we'll go with J. Miz. Old J. Mizzle Hot Sauce saying, I think Izzy wins robbery decision. I don't think you're going to get to that point. We have a lot of comments over there. Make sure you float your comments into the comment section. It helps us out a tremendous bit. But the community over here at Fight Name Picks is the greatest. So Matt, for Alex Pereira, last time out, walked in. Easy business. Didn't take any damage against Sean Strickland. For Israel Adesanya, we talked about some of these wins. And you talk about it, you know, fighting not to lose versus fighting to win, which he fought to win against Pereira. He was pouring it on him. He was pushing the pace. If you look at it for Adesanya, the only fight that we've seen recently where he's pushed the pace, that Paulo Costa fight, he wasn't messing around.
That was a while ago now, though, which is kind of wild. Like, that's been a little bit. We are a little removed from the Costa performance. But he did look great, and that was, I agree 100%, the last time we really saw that level of aggression out of Adesanya. I think Adesanya is a little bit better with his defense on the feet. I like the way he's able to slip in and out of the range. But I'll say this. I couldn't imagine the fear that you would have fighting Alex Pereira with 4-ounce gloves on. Like, okay, boxing gloves are one thing. Like, you can get knockouts in boxing, but boxing gloves are much bigger, so it lessens the impact. With 4-ounce gloves, I couldn't even imagine taking shots off the arms from a guy who hits as hard as he does. And I think there is an opportunity for him to win just because of that reason. He has incredible knockout power, very technical striker, 4-ounce gloves. But I do find myself picking Israel Adesanya. I like his volume a little bit more, and I do think he's going to be able to use the range to his benefit. And I know we disagree on this, but I could see him mixing in the clinch maybe just to try to kind of get rid of some of the separation up Pereira, so he's not as explosive at range, because I think this fight going late is going to favor Adesanya. We've seen him go late in a lot of MMA fights, and he can get stronger as the fight goes on if he's not facing a wrestling heavy attack like he did against Blachowicz. So I like Adesanya in this fight.
To me, I like Adesanya in the matchup, and I'll tell you why. You look at their defenses. I talked about it with Alex Pereira. He really does rely on, I'm going to shell up, I'm going to wait till your attack's over, and then I pour on my own. And you see that a lot in kickboxing. You see that a lot in boxing. Just peekaboo, wait, 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 and now I can counter. Oh, yeah. Now I can go. You've expended your energy, and now it's my opportunity. And for Pereira, a lot of his MMA training, you have to think, was spent on defending the takedowns, working to get back up to his feet. Did it against Mihailidis, did it against Bruno Silva. Not going to threaten with anything on the ground. I'm going to pop back up. I don't see a takedown in this fight. But the reason I have Israel Adesanya in the fight is, he hasn't changed one critical part of his game from kickboxing to MMA, and it's his striking defense. He utilizes footwork, core movement, and head movement to get out of the way. Now, you might say, well, Craig, he got knocked out. It didn't work against Pereira in the second fight. I agree with you. You're right. The first fight, he had a lot of success in the second round at the start and in the third round with his movement, with his cardio, and with his volume. And I really do like the straight shots over the looping shots. Now, normally in a fight like this, where it is so live and die by the sword, somebody with such a thunderous knockout blow with their hooks, they're able to get the win. But I will edge out Adesanya. And it doesn't have to do with the MMA training. To me, it is the defensive tactics, the volume from the outside. I like Adesanya's three-level tiered approach to his kicks versus Pereira, who He'll throw spinning attacks, but when he did against Adesanya in kickboxing fights, Adesanya was able to move right out of the way and it didn't cause him any issues. The leg kicks are definitely a big part of Pereira's game, but Adesanya is one of those guys, like we see Chris Gutierrez, whoop, I popped right out of the, whoop, I'm out of the way of those attacks. But I think this is an amazing fight. I love where the line's at as far as where the fans are voting in the community tab.
That's what makes fights so much fun. When people are that, like, down the middle on it, like, it makes more discussion happen. It makes you and your friends go back and forth about these fights. And that's what makes this so much fun at the end of the day. Like, it's not the fact that you have two great fighters. It's not the fact that these guys have a lot of Instagram followers. It's the fact that you and your friends have a lot of stuff to talk about these fights. That's what I always like the most about these pay-per-views. And I think this has a lot of fun storylines.
An amazing fight in this main event. Main event, Carlos Sparza taking on Zhang Weili. Before that, the possible fight of the year, Dustin Poirier, Michael Chandler. I know there's so many matchups that we've talked about. We've gone on for quite some time. We have question mark kicks. When is that match?
It is 2 hours before the first prelim. It gives us a chance, to go back, check over any of the previous weigh-ins, say somebody missed weight or had a really difficult weight cut. Then it just gives us the chance to go back and switch our picks. But I'll just let the cat out of the bag right now. We're on the coldest of streaks when we are switching our picks. I don't want to know how many weeks you've gotten them in a row. I know the last one I did was bad.
Four I've done it on, I've gotten them wrong. But I will say this, we have a sidekick as well. It's live during the main card. You can hang out here on the channel. You want to continue that conversation, fill up the chat. You and your cat sitting on the couch, you want to have a say with the Fight Night Picks guys, you can for sure. We've been having a great time with Fight Night Picks in 2022, and this should be an absolutely amazing card. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.